Coming up on this episode of DL Weekly, stay-at-home orders closes down some recently opened spaces, some dining is still available, Disney tickets extended.
New merchandise comes to the stores, mobile ordering comes to World of Disney, we talk with Jeff from Moustalgia and more. DL Weekly starts now.
Welcome to DL Weekly, a podcast about Walt's original Magic Kingdom, Disneyland. We cover the latest news and information from the resort, test our skills at trivia, and have a discussion about the parks every week. We invite you to send in your feedback and stories. Our contact information can be found at dlweekly.net. Now sit back, keep your hands and arms inside the podcast, and enjoy this week's show.
And welcome to this episode of DL Weekly for the week of December 9th, 2020. I'm Tag Bushman.
And I'm Teresa Urban. We would like to send a shout out and a big thank you to Allie A for supporting the show. This support helps make DL Weekly possible. Without our community support, we definitely would not have nearly as much Disney magic in our lives. And like I said, the supporter Discord has been such a wonderful source of that magic for us and for all of our supporters and listeners in there. We're actually in the middle of doing an ornament exchange. Mm-hmm. We have holiday movies that we're doing watch parties for, all sorts of fun. If you would like to become a weekly tier yourself and have some more Disney magic in your day, head on over to dealweekly.net/support to sign up.
Our friends over at Concierge have spent this entire week in Walt Disney World, and they look like they're having so much fun out there. You've seen these photos, haven't you?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Oh, if you follow their social media, they've been doing a lot of stuff. James over there at Concierge has been posting a ton of stuff. So if you want to have a lot of fun like they are currently having, get in contact with our friends over at Concierge to get started. Mention that DL Weekly sent you. Contact Concierge, and they can set up a dream Disney vacation for you. Or if you're just trying to get things planned for 2021 when Disneyland eventually reopens, you can get started with that planning as well, and they'll get something set up, and you can start talking about awesome planning of what you'd like to do.
Now let's get to the news.
This week, California entered into another stay-at-home order for much of the state. The new order allows retail stores to remain open at 20% capacity, but restricts all on-premise dining options. Carthay Circle, Award Wieners, Taste Pilots, Fiddler Pfeiffer and Practical Cafe, and outdoor vending carts will close. Retail that sells food will remain open, like Marcellin's and Trolley Treats. Disney is evaluating opening more retail locations to soak up the demand for the existing stores. 350 cast members are returning to furlough with this news.
You know, that's, I think to me, that is the saddest part about this. You know, some of these people probably just got back to work.
Yep.
Because we just reopened Buena Vista Street not that long ago. So it's really sad that people that we're having to send more people home and put people back on furlough. I do have a slight, silver lining of this is that at least, you know, Buena Vista Street in downtown Disney at this moment is still able to be open. Right now, this mainly affected, like Tag said, places to eat at. So outdoor dining is not indoor dining, outdoor dining, no dining on premise is allowed right now. So yeah, so like Carthay Circle that just opened,
yep,
closed back down. Because right, think of it, you can't really do something to go there because you're not going to buy something at Carthay Circle and then walk all the way back to your car with it.
Well, what I thought they might do, because I wasn't aware of the specifics of the stay at home, was I thought, okay, well, they don't want people dining in, so could they just sell to go and put a bunch of tables out and people could just go sit and eat? Because you're outdoors.
Yeah, kind of what they had going now, but you had table service.
Yeah, what I'm saying is like everywhere could just do everything's to go. Kind of like what has happened in a lot of other places around the country, where even if it was a dine-in restaurant before, they offered to go. So I was hoping maybe they would do something like that where people could eat there. But Disney has made it very clear in everything I've seen online in their official postings of if you buy something in downtown Disney or in Buena Vista Street, you cannot eat it on property.
Yeah.
So you can get some, we're going to talk about this in our next story, but some of the places in downtown Disney are still open for carryout, but you can't take it to, let's say, like a bench in downtown Disney and start eating. Not allowed. So very, very unfortunate. I will say, talking about restaurants and stuff, I didn't know this was a thing. So I was listening to a different podcast, not a Disney podcast, but they were talking about how some restaurants in their area, what they were doing is they were doing almost like what Texas Roadhouse was doing here, mm-hmm. where you could buy like a meal kit from the restaurant and yeah. they'd give you like the instructions and you go home and make it. And I was like, well, that could be kind of cool for Disney, because then it's like, I'll tell you, since seeing Kate's pictures of those tacos from Carthay, I really want to try those. But so that'd be cool if they could give you like a little meal kit. It's just one of those things, too. All that food and stuff that they ordered now has to get donated, and then they're going to have to go through this whole thing again when things open back up. And, of course, at this point, I think it's till after Christmas at this point, isn't it?
I'm not sure if there is really a timeline announced for it or not. Well, downtown Disney locations that are not owned by Disney are hit and miss on what is still remaining opening. So there is a really great list. We're going to have it, of course, linked for you in the show notes. So for the full list, please check out our show notes. But the following right now appear to be open, again, as of now, for takeout. So that's Black Tap Craft Burgers, Ballast Point, Earl of Sandwich, Jamba, the Jazz Kitchen Express Counter, Salt and Straw Sprinkles, and Wetzel's Pretzels, which to me kind of makes sense. Some of the places that have posted closures are places that are kind of more full meal type places. So those places would be Asian Street Eats, La Brea, Naples, Ralph Brennan's Jazz Kitchen, Splitsville, Starbucks, I was actually kind of surprised about. But I guess you don't go to downtown Disney to buy your coffee and leave.
Well, you do. I mean, not to leave, but to buy coffee. Yeah,
because remember, you're not supposed to be eating or drinking on property.
And Stephanie in our chat, who was actually just on the show a few weeks ago, said that you can't even sip your Starbucks.
Yeah. Yeah, no, they don't. No eating, no drinking. So
wow,
it's tough. And the other one's closed, Tortilla Joe's and Uva Bar. So it's very sad. But, you know, you can still get a Wetzel's pretzel, or you can get a Sprinkles cupcake, Salt and Straw ice cream. You can go get those things and take them home with you to enjoy now instead.
I feel like the ice cream, like Salt and Straw, is going to be difficult because like it's going to melt. So you'd have to get outside security and maybe get to your car and eat in your car, maybe.
I'm not sure.
You're not going to drive that home.
Because there are a lot of people that, you know, do get the ice cream to take to enjoy home. So maybe they've got some nice insulated bag or something.
Sure.
I don't know. So maybe there's good insulation, so you don't have to worry about it being a total puddle by the time you get home. It's very heartbreaking because, right, I feel like we take a couple steps forward with things getting opened back up for Disney, and then we have to take a couple steps back. So
I will say,
it is very heartbreaking, and my heart really does go out to those cast members, especially the ones that probably just got called back to go back onto furlough, not even a month later.
I will say that I'm glad that they didn't completely shut down.
Oh, yes, exactly. That's the silver lining in all of this.
With the stay-at-home order in effect through California, the planned reopening of Disney's Grand Californian has been delayed. The hotel was supposed to reopen the Disney Vacation Club Villas on Sunday, December 6th. If you booked a stay and would like to reschedule, head on over to the DVC website to make changes.
Yeah, so again, you know, all I can think about with this is more people that could have been returning to work that now aren't going to be returning to work. Well, we do have some good news for you listeners that have Disney theme park tickets that have expiration dates that may have been at the end of this year. Disney has posted updated guidelines. Unused non-promotional tickets will be extended to December 16th of 2021. Tickets still expire 13 days after the first use or December 16th, whichever comes first. For guests who have partially used tickets, those remaining days will be expanded. Those remaining days will be extended to December 16th, 2021 as well.
Yep. So basically, it's funny because their press release was very jargony and had a bunch of dates lined up all over the place. The takeaway is basically everything is good until December 16th, 2021 at this point.
You know, I think it was really, I was surprised that the partially used tickets were getting extended as well. I thought that was something that I didn't expect Disney to still honor. If you right,
like I just feel like it would cause problems.
Yeah, I just to me that doesn't seem as a cut, right? As like I have an unused ticket versus I have a partially used ticket. Because I mean, I don't know what the systems are like. Obviously, they somehow are able to know that you only use part of it. But I just figured that those may have been, you may have lost out on those ones.
Sorry, out of our control. So unfortunately, you just can't use those days.
Yeah, I don't know how that all works. So I'm glad that those people are also able to get to use the rest of your
tickets. I'm happy because I have two tickets that counts for. So as long as we go by December 16, 2021.
We will.
Let's hope.
I have faith.
I have faith, too. A whole range of items are now available at Downtown Disney. A new Jack Skellington annual pass holder popcorn bucket, which lights up in different colors, is $20. Mickey can be spotted inside of a snow globe sipper. Also an annual pass holder only offering for $17.69. A new holiday insulated tumbler is at World of Disney for $23.99. A white Christmas tree popcorn bucket for $18.99. And a new pair of mini ears, this time in cornflower blue, for $29.99. I have no idea what cornflower blue is supposed to be.
We actually have two new sets of ears this
week.
So we've got the cornflower blue ears that Tag mentioned, but we have a new Ariel under the sea Little Mermaid inspired set of
ears
as well. It's in, so I had two different links because for whatever reason, it wasn't in that article, but it was in another article with the cornflower blue ones. Just to clarify, the popcorn buckets are for sale. You just cannot purchase any popcorn with it. So you just get your collector bucket.
Which is fine for the most part.
Yeah, so the popcorn carts are still out, just
selling
minus
buckets.
Popcorn. Yeah. So now they're just bucket carts. As we reported on earlier this summer, the El Capitan Theater is expanding their custom marquee messages through the holiday season. Prices range from $25 to $200, depending on what it is that you want. The theater is also offering to-go winter cheer bundles that include Disney Parks popcorn buckets. For full details, please make sure to visit the link in our show notes.
So we talked about this on a previous episode, and you can basically get things on the marquee with a custom message that you want. And so, again, those are from $25 to $200. And it basically depends on how long the message is going to be up for and a couple other things. And then the concessions are pretty cool because they have the Mickey and Minnie white Christmas tree bucket, which we just talked about mm-hmm. in the last story. They have a Mickey balloon bucket, which looks like it's a yellow color. An alien plaid bucket, which I think was, what, last year or 2 years ago's bucket? There
yeah,
was something
that was
similar?
Yep, that was a previous year's bucket.
There's this Sven, which I think was last year.
Yeah, Sven sipper. Yep,
yeah.
It was pretty cool.
And then they've got some things that looks like they come with like you can get a couple ones that have some masks and some hand sanitizer and stuff, and some that just come with some little good treats there. So you can order those through the El Capitan Theater.
I think it's very fun, right? It's like a way to bring Disney magic, fun for collectors that maybe wanted some of these items from the past that weren't able to get your hands on them. Now you can get it.
Anywhere that you have another spot that you can get some of these things that are in good demand is good.
Mm-hmm.
Guests have become accustomed to mobile ordering of food around the parks, so Disney has added mobile ordering to World of Disney. The system is testing at the moment, but it may help speed up your shopping experience. Guests will grab a designated shopping bag, scan items you wish to buy, and place them in the bag, pay for the items through your phone, and then show a cast member a QR code as you exit. Now, one thing that I think is really neat, because one of the biggest problems I have at shopping for Disney is they put color codes on a lot of things. So you have to like go find the price. The neat thing is with the app, you kind of just point your phone at the item and it like knows what the item looks like and it'll put it in. So you don't even have to scan a barcode.
Wow.
And I've seen this. Amazon kind of does this if you use their app, if you're like in a store and trying to do a price match. And sometimes it'll work. But I think that for Disney, this could be really cool because like you're looking at plush or something, right? And you can just aim it and it'll pop it in there and it'll tell you the price.
That blows my mind. That is, I don't know, there's some sort of Tinkerbell pixie dust or like magic from the genie is making that work because that's amazing. How cool.
Yeah. So what do you think? Would you use mobile?
You know, I would be a nerd and just do it. Because it sounds really cool. Not necessarily because maybe it's more convenient or faster. I would do it just to see how it works because that sounds really, really neat to me. But this is right perfect timing to have something like this come out. Gives guests another option so you're not having to necessarily wait in line or at least opens it up so that there's another space to go. So not, you know, I like it. I like the convenience of it. I also like that, you know, depending on if you're one of those people that knows exactly what you're going in, and you just want to get in and out, maybe this is a much better option for you than having to wait in the line.
So I'm wondering if they changed this, because when this was announced, I mean, they're still testing, but when this was announced before, it had the, like, just aim it at the item.
Mm-hmm.
Their official sign that's in the store says scan the barcode.
Oh,
so I don't know if that's just not a feature that they're trying to push right now, but I had seen like a video of this where somebody was doing it.
So how does this work? So you go through the store shopping like you're normally shopping, scanning as you go and like taking it up to the front. And it's kind of like, I don't know, if you go to Sam's Club or something and they verify that what you scanned and what you physically have is correct. And so they give you a bag and you go on your merry way.
Yeah. So basically, you grab a bag as you scan the things, you put it in your in the bag. So you're basically bagging your own stuff as you purchase things. And then you just check in with somebody at the end like, hey, this is my stuff.
That sounds kind of dangerous.
What do you mean?
Like, scan bag, scan bag.
Oh, yeah.
Because you're not like having to like, don't have the regret of when you're standing in line like, but do I really need this
other
set of ears?
That's true. But like, you'll see the price right away and you might be like,
impulse buyer's worst nightmare. Just be like, beep, 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 beep. Here we go.
I like the idea because like that, like when we were at World Disney and Disney World, I just wanted my couple little things. If I could have just scanned.
Exactly. I think it's convenient. Why not offer another option?
Yeah.
Well, with the closures of the parks this holiday season, a gap in holiday entertainment for some guests has appeared, and Disney has offered a solution. The 2019 Epcot Candlelight Processional has been posted online to take place of the annual holiday event. The event posted online is hosted by none other than Neil Patrick Harris.
I feel like I need to watch this because I don't think I've ever actually watched a full Candlelight Processional. Yeah. So I am sad that this is the Epcot version just because I feel like the Disneyland one is so... It's like the Fantasmic, right? Because they turn a normal place into something spectacular, where at Epcot, it's done in like one of their big venues.
Right, yeah. I've never experienced a full Candlelight Processional, so I definitely will be checking this out. Maybe, fingers crossed, maybe the Disneyland version will come out too. I don't know. But I do think it's nice because one thing, right, with all the crap that's going on, we have to like be excited for things still, right? So I just, it's really fun and really cool to me that Disney is making this stuff available for people that aren't physically in the parks. Because, you know, if they wouldn't have put this online, you and I would have never gotten to see this because we weren't present. We weren't able to be there to live it. So I think it's great that they're making this stuff accessible.
I'm just glad they recorded it.
Oh, yeah.
Same thing with those we reported on before of like the Disney Cruise Line like theater productions. Yeah, I'm just glad they recorded them.
No, exactly.
Liberty, to answer your question about who hosted the Disneyland ones, each night they have, well, Epcot's different because Epcot has a bunch of different nights, I think. And usually it's a different host each night or some nights or whatever. Yeah, so it's been tons of different people. Who was it? Was it Chris Pratt? Who was the one who made
Yeah, that was Chris Pratt like 2 years ago that had the like weird
He like stumbled over his word and was like, oh, that wasn't right.
Yeah. I don't remember exactly what it was, but there was some sort of fumble in there with Chris Pratt. But yes, it was Lin-Manuel Miranda last year.
Yeah.
Dusty. All sorts of amazing names that host the Candlelight Procession. I wonder how you get like, how do you as a celebrity get to be on that list to be like, can I please?
They probably just reach out and then it's up to you to say yes or no.
Yeah.
I don't think that you personally put yourself on the list. I think they come to you.
But like, that's got to be like such a high honor, especially if you're a celebrity that's a huge Disney fan.
Well, I think they're all Disney people, right? So like, Neil Patrick Harris has done a bunch of stuff for Disney, Lin-Manuel Miranda, Chris Pratt.
Yeah.
James Earl Jones, I think, hosted it one of the years. So it's always people that have like are big celebrities for Disney. Dusty Sage over at Mice Chat posted a tour of Walt Disney's Storybook Mansion in the Hollywood Hills. The tour was posted to the Storybook Mansion Facebook page and is linked in our show notes. This was the mansion where Walt's picture was taken and appeared on the cover of his biography, Walt Disney, An American Original, and featured in the Disney Plus show Prop Culture.
See, something else that like is exciting that we wouldn't have been able to experience this year. Definitely Disney bucket list item for sure to like if we could ever go on a tour there ourselves. But I just think it's so cool that we get to virtually experience some of these things that we otherwise maybe would not have had the chance to do.
Shout out to Dusty Sage too, because he's been doing a lot of like live videos. So just a couple weeks ago, he was in Aulani and he did a tour of Aulani streamed to the Mice Chat Facebook page. He did this thing with the Storybook Mansion. He also did the first the media preview day for Buena Vista Street and he was walking around and showing stuff. So he's been a very busy person when it's come to stream stuff. So keep an eye out on, you know, if you guys are interested in seeing this stuff when it pops up right away, I would implore you, you know, go subscribe, go like the Mice Chat page on Facebook. And the Walt Disney Storybook Mansion. Also, I want to point out, the Walt Disney Family Museum has been posting a lot of their virtual talks on their Facebook page. And they're only up for like a couple days at a time. So I would also go and like the Walt Disney Family Museum page, because one of the things I actually registered for a couple weeks ago, I watched live, and then 2 days later was on their Facebook page, and it was up for 48 hours. And I meant to download it because I wanted to keep it, because it was a really great talk. And I missed that 48-hour period.
Oh,
yeah, so there's a lot of stuff. If you're starved for Disney, there's definitely a lot of stuff going on. Mm-hmm. Speaking of which, did you watch the sing-along and stuff? I don't think we talked about our thoughts.
I have not gotten through the sing-along yet. Did I tell you? So it's cold here, right? We live in the Midwest. And this is like way, way off topic, but I promise I'm coming back around. So for work, I've been doing a lot of office work, and I need to move. Like, I need to be doing stuff. Office work is terrible for me. So it's cold out, so I don't want to go take the dogs for a walk, because I'm like a chicken when it comes to cold, which is not a good thing when you live in the Midwest. So anyway, so we have a treadmill, and so I got all excited, because right, treadmills are kind of boring. So I got all excited when I got my iPad Air recently. So I was like, oh wait, I can download Disney Plus and I can watch Disney Plus while I'm on the treadmill. So the first thing I started to watch was the Disney Family Sing-Along. However, I have not finished it yet. Almost done.
I'm
taking it in little chunks.
I have one
really so much fun.
Silly thing to complain about.
Okay.
Ryan Seacrest looks terrible with facial hair.
It is what it is. I don't know.
I don't know if I'll put this in the full podcast recording, but for you guys listening, I just want to comment on this. This is hilarious. So James and I were talking, and because both of us worked in TV, so we kind of know how some of these things are put together. Mm-hmm. And James and I were like, because we watched it together, and it was so funny because he was like, or I said to James, I said, you know what's funny? Do you think that they like recorded this like back to back to back, like, because they like he intros something and then they play it and then something, and I'm like, so it was so funny because they would come out of a performance, he'd be like, that was just wonderful. And I'm like, isn't it funny, because he probably has no idea what just played. Yeah. So he has to like continue, but as the show went on, he got more like fake about it, because I think like he had all of his genuine kind of excitement had gone away. So I was just laughing, because I was like, you realize that he probably was like, all right, take one, and he's like, welcome to the Disney sing-along, and first we're gonna go see so and so, and then like, okay, and go, wasn't that wonderful, blah 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 blah, now this, and then he had to do the same thing. So I just, and then it was funny because there were some times where like he had to talk to the laptop. But then, like, the very next shot when he, like, turned away, the laptop was gone. So I'm like, well, obviously that was recorded into. It's just, I noticed these weird things. I just thought it was funny. I like Ryan Seacrest. I wish Disney wasn't so polished with some of their things. Like, I wish it was more, less scripted. Like, I wish people could go off the cuff and be more natural. Because I feel like every Disney special kind of sounds the same, like they have the same writer for everything, and it doesn't matter who hosts it all sounds the same, but it is enjoyable.
There you go. Liberty said it's his quarantine look.
Yeah,
his hair was longer too.
Stephanie agrees with me. Mm-hmm. Though doesn't look good with facial hair.
He looks older to me.
I wasn't even the look older, it just, there was something about like it wasn't full enough, or it was a weird shape or something.
The thing too with Ryan Seacrest is I think of him like, I don't know, he's very like clean cut.
Yeah.
Like his hair is always very, like, very well styled or whatever. So I don't know. So it was just weird to see him not kind of that like clean cut type look.
Sure.
If that makes sense.
You're right. Cause like he's got that like boyish quality to him. When you put a beard on that, it doesn't quite come off. I don't see anything that looks like it did for the sing along thing though. I'm just doing a quick, anyway, it doesn't matter. They had two different ones recently that both had Derek and Juliet. So what was the other one? Was that the Thanksgiving?
The holiday
celebration. Mm-hmm. They did a great job hosting, actually, because I thought they had a little bit of playfulness. It didn't seem as scripted. The only thing that seemed scripted was when they cut to the guy who was over in Disney World, who was by himself, and like,
that poor guy.
So much easier when you've got two, right? Like, if I had to do this podcast alone, it'd be very weird.
Well... Moving on. The National Minority Supplier Development Council has named Disney the Corporation of the Year for positively impacting the diverse supplier community. It is the highest honor that the NMSDC offers.
So this is basically for Disney using different suppliers and trying to find a variety of suppliers. So finding people, companies and stuff that are led by diverse owners and high, you know, that they hire diverse, you know, very diversely and stuff like that. So very good. I mean, yeah. That goes along with their inclusion fifth key.
Oh,
that they
for sure. Yes, definitely. The diversity team works very hard to create basically like an inclusive supply line, like Tag was saying, where they then identify diverse suppliers to then help them as a company deliver world-class entertainment and all the wonderful experiences to guests in the theme park and all the resorts throughout the world. It's cool because, right, not only when they partner with these diverse companies, not only are they helping those companies with their growth, but it also helps with, you know, enriching Disney's content. You know, it's a great partnership because not only are they helping these companies, it's also helping Disney too. So I think it's wonderful.
Now it's time to take a trip to Trivia Land, where producer Vern will try to stump us with some Disney trivia. He'll ask us four questions, maybe a bonus. We'll attempt to answer, emphasis on the attempt, and we'll get the correct answers after the discussion topic. So what do you have for us this week, Vern?
Well, thanks to our wonderful listeners who take such good care of producer James and I am able to go into our listener-submitted questions and find some for you here. Couple that I feel may be gimmies for you, but maybe aren't. I don't know.
Maybe.
I don't know. As I'm reading them, I have the answers right here. And for me, I'm looking at it going, maybe they know these, but maybe not. So we'll see how you do. We will see how you do. So for question number one, submitted by listener Brittany R., who designed the famous purple wallpaper in the Haunted Mansion?
Oh, dang it. I just saw this. She was
and
like,
this one I thought was going to be a gimme.
She was an interior designer, and she helped design all sorts of things in New Orleans Square, including
the Haunted Mansion wallpaper.
The Haunted Mansion wallpaper. Dang it. Because this, I think, was on Imagineering Story.
I think so, too.
I'm fairly certain. And it was so funny because she just kind of picked it and didn't realize it was going to be like the big like thing that it is.
This is why I'm having problems, because I just our discussion topic this week is with an author of a book, and I've been reading, it's about the Haunted Mansion. Mm-hmm. So I'm not quite to the point where I might know that. Dang.
Yeah, but it was, I'm almost positive it was in the Imagineering Story, and I yep. don't remember what the lady's name was.
Well, you don't. I definitely don't.
But she picked a bunch of the stuff. Like, she helped pick a bunch of stuff out to, like, decorate the interior of the mansion, including the wallpaper. But I don't remember what her name is.
Hmm.
Dang it. Okay. Well, that was a flop.
I was like, we didn't even have any guesses for that one.
So your official answer is, I don't remember.
Yeah.
Something in the Imagineering Story.
Dang it.
Okay. We'll go with that. Your second question from listener Jill M. When you are on the Mark Twain riverboat, what does the narrator tell you Tom Sawyer always wanted to be?
We're doing terrible with this. I don't.
Tom
Sawyer always wanted to be, I don't know, a pirate.
I've listened to the spiel from this a couple times.
We're doing terrible.
He wanted to be. You said a pirate, right?
Yeah, I said a pirate.
Lee That's also only... in our chat said pirate, so I'm going to go with pirate.
That's the only thing I can think is a pirate.
That's your guess?
That's
a pirate.
That's our guess.
Okay. That's definitely a guess.
Okay, that is a guess. Your third question, submitted by listener Donna S. What were the names of the turkeys that were grand marshal for the Thanksgiving Day parade at Disneyland?
These are so hard this week.
Mickey and Minnie, I don't know.
Tom, Turkey Tom, and Tom, I don't know.
This isn't a good start to this.
This is terrible. Tom and his friend.
Tom and his friend. Doris, his friend Doris.
Tom and Doris, there you
go. Tom and Doris.
Tom and Doris. Okay.
This is awful. This is an embarrassing trivia trip to Trivia Land this week for sure.
Yes.
And your fourth regular question from listener Lee S. Mickey and Minnie's Runaway Railroad is advertised as the first Disney Parks attraction based on Mickey Mouse. This, however, is not true. What is the first Disney Parks attraction to actually be based on Mickey Mouse?
Well, I mean, if you're counting like Meet Mickey in his house, then that could be it. I guess maybe you could count like the Main Street Cinema because that's all of his like shorts playing in there. But that doesn't, I mean, those aren't like attractions.
And you said, did you say Disney Parks? Like, it like outside of Disney, like, is it a Disneyland?
What is
it
the
Disneyland?
First Disney Parks attraction based on Mickey Mouse?
Disney Parks attraction based on Mickey Mouse. Yeah, I guess I don't know, because the only thing I could, that's all that came to mind too, is if you consider like the cinema or the meet and greet in his house attractions, which, I mean, they are.
They are attractions.
What about, it could be Mickey's Fun Wheel, but that's not like based on him. That's just named after him. There's lots of like, could be options.
There's lots of like nods for sure. But was there some, I'm thinking like, I don't know. Because all I thought was, the Mickey Mouse Club Circus, but that's not really based on Mickey Mouse.
No. I think we just leave it there. We've guessed a lot
too.
Of things.
Oh, man, that was a tough one.
So are those your final answers?
Yeah, as sad as they are.
If one of those is correct, that's the one we're going with.
Okay. Dang. And your bonus question, submitted by listener Lori D. What are the names of the train engines on Big Thunder Mountain Railroad?
Oh, my goodness.
This is the same thing like with...
like the names of the boats.
Yeah, like they're all cute.
Yeah, they're all fun. But I don't pay attention. I'm too excited when I'm waiting in line, and you and I typically try and get to the back, so we're not near the front to like see the engine. Man,
I've seen the names though, and
we need to like hand in our podcast like host
just the trivia,
cards.
Just the Man. Trivia. They're silly. They're like play on names kind of things.
Yeah, but I don't even know like what, where they'd even like, are they all R's?
I think
are
there's
all, you know?
Four of them, Barb. I think there's four trains, but I could be wrong.
Five.
There might be five.
It's kind of like, because like five. The pirates boats all are named too, if you pay close attention. Dang.
They're fun names. That's all
Mining,
I got.
Mining, Mayhem,
This is what makes my trivia editing so hard, because you just start like throwing stuff at the wall. Okay. Nothing?
Dynamite. Don. Dynamite Don. I don't know.
Vern, that's our answers.
Those are your guesses?
Yes.
Okay. Well, listeners, how do you think they did tonight?
Terribly.
Awful.
Hey, peanut gallery.
We need to turn in all of the cards. We need to turn the Haunted Mansion card back in. We need to turn the
You'd think we'd be better
Big
at like
Mountain
Big Thunder
Railroad.
And stuff.
We
These
need to turn in our Mickey Mouse card. Like all the cards have to be returned.
Yeah.
And listeners, how did you do listening at home?
Hopefully better than us.
I hope so. Man.
Keep listening after the discussion topic to find out how you did.
Well, this week for our discussion topic, we are talking with Jeff from DoomBuggies.com and the Nostalgia Podcast. And I've already butchered the name. I'm so sorry, Jeff. Welcome to the show.
No, that was really good. Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here. No, that's good. Nostalgia. Yep, you got it.
Do you ever get feedback to your show about the pronounceability of your podcast?
Oh, yeah. Well, Bob Gurr, one of our very first guests or, you know, significant Disney guests was Bob Gurr. And he was like, Moose-a-talgia. I'm proud to be on Moose-a-talgia. So, yeah, I mean, I kind of had hoped it was an interesting, unusual name. It's just basically nostalgia for Disney, you know, Mouse-talgia.
Yeah.
And I thought it was original. I honestly thought just that came to my head and I thought it up. And I it was going to be a blog at some point, but I registered the domain name and had it for a couple of years. And I've since found out that sometime in the, I think it was the 90s, the New York Times did an article about a Mickey Mouse collector, and their headline had the word Mouse-talgia in it. Like they had come up with the same basic thought process, right?
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, I never had seen that before this. But yeah, people, you know, I don't know, people don't seem too concerned until they have to say it. Like, they're like, oh.
Sure, it's like one of those things, right? When, like, I remember this is so off topic, but like the Harry Potter books, how I read the names of the characters and then it was said out loud
like
in the
movie
the
stuff,
movies
yeah.
And you're like, oh, that's completely not what I thought it was.
Yeah.
Language, man. Language is challenging. So, Jeff, what is your Disney story? How did you get involved with Disney? What is where did your passion for this come from when you were young to where you are today?
Yeah, that is a great question, actually, because I'm asked that often, and it's interesting how my answer has actually changed. And you would think, how can your answer change? Like, there must be just one story there, but there really isn't for me. I mean, I went as a kid a lot. I did not grow up in Southern California, so I wasn't an all the time in the park kid. I was an annual park visitor, right?
Sure,
and my parents had friends. My parents grew up in LA, so they dated and went to Disneyland, you know, and then they had friends down there. So once a year we'd go down. Their friends had kids about the same age, so they'd take us kids to Disneyland. This is like mid 70s, I'd say. And they would just dump us there. And they would go off to Knott's to have their chicken dinner and enjoy themselves, right? And they would just leave us, the four of us, just, I guess they figured like four little kids, at least someone's going to be responsible, you know, out of the group of us. And we would just be there all day long with a couple books of tickets and, you know, nothing but freedom. So
nice.
That's kind of how I grew up. So I have very distinct memories of the Disneyland of the 70s and 80s, you know, Adventure Through Inner Space,
yeah.
And all of those kind of People Mover and all those things.
All the People Mover.
Yeah. But that's not, I mean, so that's kind of a bedrock, right? Really, my involvement in the Disney community started around the mid 90s when there were news groups about Disney. And I am I'm a graphic designer and a teacher by trade. And I've always been interested in marketing and, you know, that kind of thing. And so my interest in Disney kind of had that commercial end of things, kind of how they market themselves.
Oh,
I'm interested in collecting and history, that part of Disney.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I was taking part in the news groups and things. There was Rec Art Disney and Rec Art Disney Parks. And, you know, you could basically converse with people, similar to Twitter, but there was no limit, you know, what you could say. So that dragged me back into the Disney world. Somehow I decided to make a website. It was really because I graduated with my art degree in design and I didn't have to take a single computer class. Photoshop existed then. I think it was the first couple of years that there was Photoshop, but websites were still kind of mostly GeoCities, like here's my favorite rock band or, you know, a tribute to my pet, you know, and it was all that kind of thing. And I thought I really should learn how to do website design because that's going to be what people want to hire me to do. So I just made a website about the Haunted Mansion because that happened to be, here's the other side of me. Like I'm also a Halloween kid, a monster kid from the late 60s. I was born in the late 60s and I just loved Universal Monsters and, you know, Famous Monsters Magazine and all of that kind of stuff. I love that stuff. So the Haunted Mansion is the Disney and the monsters coming together, right? So I just had been a Haunted Mansion fan. I had a good collection of stuff, you know, new articles and pictures and things that Disneyland had printed. And so I thought, I'm just going to make a website about this and teach myself HTML. I made it. It was like, and I made up a name, Chef Mayhem, because I had an AOL account. You could make up all these names, right? So I thought, I'm going to make a hacker sounding, you know, name. So instead of Jeff Bam, Chef Mayhem, right? And so I made this up and I started a website about the Haunted Mansion. And people loved it. Like I put it out on the news groups and everyone kind of was excited to kind of start visiting and sending me stuff. And cast members sent me little sound clips and people sent me pictures they had flashed or, you know, behind the scenes and all that kind of stuff. And I started gathering all this stuff. And I thought I better turn this into a real website. So I made the domain doombuggies.com and then I started Doombuggies. So that's kind of, and that was 1997. And so, since then, I have just kind of become more interested in the Haunted Mansion. People have kind of come to me over the years with their stories and their information and their experience either designing the ride or working on the attraction or, you know, all kinds of from Imagineers to cast members. And it's just become kind of a hub for Haunted Mansion fandom. Kind of the peak of it was when websites were a thing, you know, in the 2000s, when the Haunted Mansion movie came out with Eddie Murphy, Disney contacted us and said, hey, do you want to, it was one of a few interactions we actually had with the Disney company. And they've all been positive, And then we said, yeah, we would love to be, you know, part of that grassroots thing. So we had a big, huge, thriving message board. This is right at the verge of social media, right? So message boards were the thing. So we had thousands of people and, The Doombuggies was kind of, that was when my kind of involvement in the Disney fan community had pretty much cemented itself around who I am and my interests and things like that. With Doombuggies. Yeah. And then in the around 2007, I think it is. I bought the domain Mousetalgia because I just thought I was interested in Disney history and Imagineering, and I knew I wanted an outlet for that. And I thought it might be a blog about Disney history. And it turned out that one of my friends who loves Disneyland as much as I did, we were just chatting, and I had known Lou Mangiello, and he started his podcast. I had known Ricky, who started Inside the Magic. Like, they were friends of mine, and they mm-hmm. were starting these podcasts. And I thought, you know what? We could maybe do something similar. They're all on the East Coast. Let's do something on the West Coast. So we started Mousetalgia, about 12 years ago. And it's taken off ever since then, and here we are.
That's fascinating. I want to go back to how, like, doombuggies.com just kind of was this little, like, basically you teaching yourself how to build a website, and it, like, boomed into this like, hub for all things Haunted Mansion. That's crazy. That's amazing.
Yeah, you know, it was fortunate. People have kind of asked about, you know, the Haunted Mansion is interesting, right? Because it has this crazy fan base. And there
Teresa's
are other
a member.
Yes, I am a member.
I am too. And, you know, it's kind of like, you know, there are other attractions that I would argue are more popular than the Haunted Mansion.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like Pirates is probably, if you ask the world, like, what's your favorite Disneyland attraction? I bet Pirates would take the lead over Haunted Mansion.
Sure,
Maybe even Space Mountain. You know, not like it's the number one attraction, but somehow it reaches enough little niches of people, you know, mm-hmm. like the goth community loves the Haunted Mansion for their reasons. Actors love the Haunted Mansion for their reasons. Artists, you know, all these different kind of communities love it for slightly different reasons, but they can all kind of come under this umbrella.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah, so it kind of took off. Yeah, like a rocket.
You took me through my early computer days telling that story, because I was remembering AOL and I was remembering, I think I ended up on your website early on because when I first got on the internet, I was looking for Disney stuff, and I'm pretty sure I ended up at Doombuggies at some point, because I don't think there was that much there. There was Intercot West, I think I used to go to a lot, and I don't know. I think they're still around, but not really like as big as they were. Then there was you and a couple others that I just remember going to all the time. And Intercot West I liked because they had a lot of photos, which a lot of mm-hmm. other sites weren't doing at the time. So they were one of the first websites I went to that had, like, you know, weekly photo update things. And I was always like, yes. And this was when California Adventure was being built. So there was all types of construction, you know, and all that stuff. So super cool. I see you still have some forums. It looks like linked off of the Doombuggies as well. And they're still pretty happening.
There's a handful of people that still meet over there. I do link to them. I am not running those forums.
Sure.
So I don't, you know, I'm allowing it to be what it is, their own little community. Doombuggies officially uses social media. So we have Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. That's it's affiliated, but it's not, I don't like actually have any organizational lead over them. So whatever happens over there. But you know, there's still some people that want their own little community, right? And so that's still happening. I actually rebuilt this Doombuggies for the 50th anniversary of the Haunted Mansion. So 2 years ago, I spent a whole year.
Wow.
Like, I recoded the whole thing. I rewrote the whole thing. I put all the, because I had probably a decade's worth of stuff I'd collected that never really made it onto the website.
Yeah.
And I updated it for no good reason. Like, people don't use websites anymore. You know what I mean? Like, it's not, I mean, people will go to visit it, but it's really just an archive of Haunted Mansion stuff. But, you know, the long and short of it, Doombuggies is not really a, you know, the social media parts is where we try to engage people with what's happening in the Haunted Mansion. And, but, you know, it's not really as a website. I was mostly just literally a labor of love because I just had to get it out so that Doombuggies is.
But here's what I'll tell you, Jeff. I'll tell you. So my company, I do small business IT stuff. And I just want to tell you quick here because we got a ton of stuff to get to. But I tell my clients all the time with websites that social media is the thing right now. But you don't have a lot of control over that. And we've seen that, of course, this last year, you know, that certain things are being surfaced and certain things are being buried and whatever. So, you know, we actually had a client that's a nonprofit, and their page right before they did this virtual fundraiser got taken off of Facebook, and there was no, like, they tried to contact them before this, and they still don't have their page up, and it's been like 2 months. And wow. So, yeah. And so it's just one of those things where, you know, you don't have a lot of control over it. Sure, there's a lot of people there, but it won't always be there. So I tell all the clients that I work with, I say, have a website, use social media to push people to your website, because you can put whatever you want on your website. Social media, like, they can bury that stuff. You know, people may like it or not like it. You know, they've changed over the years.
Yeah.
When Facebook first started, it was like chronological, and like you could see everything that was ever posted. Now it's like, you know, they have the algorithm. And so I don't know. I don't it's like true. Social media for that, but it is where the people are. So I'll give you that. Yeah. But I think I love your website. I'm going to, after all this, I'm going to spend a lot of time browsing around, because it is a gorgeous website, by the way.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate that.
Yeah.
Well, when we're going to go back to our
get out of
the tech talk. So when you entered Disneyland, so this is like, think of like the first day in your parks of a trip. Is there a certain way that you like to go? Do you tend to go left towards Adventureland? Do you go forward towards Fantasyland? Take a right to Tomorrowland? What's kind of your attack of the park?
Yeah, that's a good, that has changed over the years drastically. Like this last year, I always would go straight through Fantasyland to the castle, turn left at Monstro, and go straight to Galaxy's Edge, right?
So
things changed a lot for me. I mean, the true answer is I've never had that as a distinct pattern. It's
sure.
always been whoever I'm with, like, what do we want to do first?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it really has changed a lot. I mean, on Mousetalgia, we give lots of great advice about, like, this is how to tackle the park sometimes. But to be honest, we don't take our advice ourselves very much. You know what I mean? Because there is a way, like, if you're going to go once in 10 years, yeah, maybe be strategic, right? But we don't. And I don't go once every 10 years, you know? So if it's all right if I'm just going to Disneyland to have a Bengal barbecue, because a lot of times that's literally why I would walk into the park, right? So then obviously I'd be turning left, but, or, you know, heading to the west. But Jen, I'm going to tell you what I would do for most of my childhood. So it's none of those things. We would go through under the plaques, and we would make a U-turn up into the train station, and we'd take the Grand Circle Tour. So the first thing I would actually do is take the circle tour around the park. Because my friends, when we were little back in the 80s, 70s and 80s, right, we would just want to spend that time looking at our ticket books, planning out what we were going to do. But although, you know, to be fair, we always would go right. We would go into Tomorrowland. We would ride the People Mover. We wanted to do the stuff that showed you Disneyland, right? So
yeah.
We would first do the train so we could see everything. Then we'd go on the People Mover so we could look over Tomorrowland and see inside the Adventure Through Inner Space. Then we would ride Adventure Through Inner Space as our third attraction. Like, that was the 1, 2, 3 of my childhood. Grand Circle Tour, People Mover, Adventure Through Inner Space.
That's solid.
And I don't know. Yeah, I don't know why, but that's just what we did. And then it would be like just a fight all day long over what are we going to do next. Right? So, but I distinctly remember that.
I think Teresa did that too. I think she was kind of getting into that she likes to get on the train and kind of just get the lay of the land kind of thing. But I've ruined her. I'm a down Main Street and over to Indy, basically, is my big thing.
Well, that's not bad. I mean, you know, Bengal barbecue's on the way, so yeah. I can support that.
You know, years, I had heard about Bengal barbecue but did not have it. And then I had it, and I was like, why did I wait so long to try this? Although, if you haven't tried the bao buns at the Tropical Hideaway, that is also very good now.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. And, you know, I mean, Bengal barbecue, to be fair, couple people wrote me, maybe it was a year or two ago, and they said, you know what, it wasn't that great. And so I said, what are you speaking of? So I went there, and I did have a meal or two over the years. I've had a couple tough kebabs there before, so I'm not going to say it's like sit down dining or anything. It is, you know, counter dining. They're making a trillion of those things every hour, so it's not like. But having said that, like, it's the rub and the spices and the flavor they use, right? And for me, like, there's nothing. I would eat that over the Napa Rose. Like, the Bengal barbecue is what I want for dinner.
Well, and it's a good budget item too. But I'll tell you, I also missed out on this when we went for D23. Teresa and Vern had
a Ronto wrap.
The Ronto wrap. And I didn't have an official Ronto wrap until we went to Disney World a couple months ago. And life-changing. That thing is amazing. Like, that is now on my must-have every visit at some point list.
Yeah, you know, it's really good. Disneyland has always had, well, you know, so we talk on Mousetalgia about the food there and how it compares with other theme park food, even Disney World food, because Disneyland has a lot of competition, even across the street, right?
Yeah.
So they have to be pretty on their game. But, you know, it's always been a little bit different. I mean, they had the Tahitian Terrace. They've always had, you could always get a steak dinner or something delicious at Disneyland from most of its history.
Yeah.
So it's always had something worth your time. But yeah, you know, Disneyland food is some people, that's all it's about.
I'm just glad it came back because we've talked about this in our supporter chat that there was a period of time there. I want to say maybe late 90s, early 2000s, where the food just wasn't great.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm so glad that it seems like they've realized that they can make a fortune at food.
Yeah.
If they just make it good and make unique things that people can't get anywhere else, obviously. Yeah. You know, like the Ronto wrap, like the Bengal barbecue.
The gray stuff.
Yeah. The gray stuff. So this one, I'm sure, is going to be difficult. And I feel like... you know, usually people answer like a current attraction, but since you've been there and there's been a few attractions that have come and gone, I will open this for anything. What is your favorite attraction?
Yeah, everyone thinks I'm going to say the Haunted Mansion. And the truth is, I was scared of the Haunted Mansion as a kid. I wouldn't ride it as a kid. I was a timid kid. And also, the part of my story that I just skipped over because I don't know, I just is the role that Disneyland Records had in my Disney fandom. It was a huge role. My parents would not buy us, my sister and I, disco records in the 70s because that was not, you know, something that they would support, but they would buy us every Disneyland record under the sun, right? So we had, and also they were leaders of a youth group, so they did a haunted house every year. So we had always copies of Chilling Thrilling Sounds of the Haunted House in our home. And we also always had a copy of the Haunted Mansion in our home.
Mm-hmm.
And that record, because I was a monster kid, right? So that was my Disneyland record. I would listen to it. I would draw the pictures in it. I would trace them and break the records. And my parents
oh,
would,
no.
When I was in college, I was going through our old record cabinet. And I was like, why do we have 3 Haunted Mansion books? And my mom said, well, you remember you used to break them all the time. So I just, you know, the Haunted Mansion, I knew what was in there, right? When I was a little kid, I knew what was in there and I did not want to actually meet those things
in
real life. So I just was scared of the Haunted Mansion. I did not want to go on it. I was probably in junior high by the time I went on. I don't remember when I first went on the Haunted Mansion. It was probably before then, but I was at least 7 or 8 before I would go on the Haunted Mansion. So I mean, Adventure Through Inner Space, I loved that. I was probably the one that said, I don't care what we do all day long, but the first thing we do is going to be Adventure Through Inner Space, because it was just weird and kind of science-y. And I was into that as a kid, you know, collecting rocks and all that kind of stuff. And I just loved that attraction, and it was science fiction and it was a little creepy. And so I would have to say it could be Adventure Through Inner Space.
That's a solid one.
That is a good one.
Yeah. I wish there was a good, I mean, I wish cameras were as good as they are now, because sometimes we go back, and I was trying to show Teresa, when we went to Disney World, the Journey into Imagination with Figment, like the original, and there's just not a good version of that. Same thing with Adventure Through Inner Space. There's just not a good version somewhere.
Yeah, that's true. Actually, there's a 3D recreation going around, and it's actually pretty, to the best of my recollection, you know, it ended sometime in the 80s, so I did it quite a few times, but it's a pretty accurate representation. You know, if you kind of get the feel of a jiggly Haunted Mansion, because you're in a Omnimover, like the Haunted Mansion,
sure.
You can kind of get that feel in your body, you know, like shaking around a little bit, it's very similar to the
put yourself in an office chair and wiggle back
there
and forth a little bit.
There you go. Yeah, exactly.
A broken office chair, though, so it's a little more not as
oh yeah
gives you some bumps. Let's get into the meat of this. I am fascinated that basically that Mousetalgia started as what was going to be a blog and then kind of turned into this big huge podcast. We were talking a little bit before, and it was kind of one of the first major Disneyland specific podcasts, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I was mostly focused on Walt Disney World podcasts, as most people were. And props to the Disneyland Gazette. I think they were around before Mousetalgia. And I don't remember a lot of the if there were many other Disneyland podcasts. I think some podcasts did some Disneyland stuff. But I knew that the big popular Disney fan podcasts were East Coast based. And yeah. I thought, you know, we can do something similar to this for the West Coast because it's where I live and this is the park I know and love. And also because it's just soaked in history. Like the East Coast park has its history that it is also steeped in, but it's very distinct from, because Disneyland's history goes all the way back and has tendrils into the films and the animated features, and all of the early Imagineers worked on all of those, mm-hmm. or not all of them, but a lot of them worked on those animated features. So, you know, it has a history that's just very distinct from the East mm-hmm. Coast. And I love Disney history. So I just kind of wanted to, that's why, as you say, I was thinking about starting a blog, right? And then I just, you know, a couple of friends of mine were big Disneyland fans. And one of them I found out had a broadcast background. And so he had a lot of equipment. One of them was a big resort person, and I was not. I had never had the money to stay in the resorts, so I was more of the $50 a night hotel person. Mm-hmm. So we had like all of these bases covered, right? And I collected Disneyana, and I was a big history fan. Mm-hmm. So we had all these bases covered. So we thought, let's give this a shot, and we did.
That's amazing, and you're right. Like the history alone of Disneyland is just, I think, what makes it so fascinating. And I do think it's. I mean, we're a little biased here, right? But I do think it is more charming also than Walt Disney World too, just because I feel like the level of detail to the park itself is just different than the other parks.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, right? Because Disneyland is reflects Walt's vision for mm-hmm. family entertainment, right? It's a direct reflection of what he wanted to do. Now, Walt was a dreamer, right? So he always thought, what's the next thing? What's the next thing? So by the time Walt Disney World came around, it almost was, in my view of the Walt Disney World history, which is not full and accurate, just so you know, it's not something I've studied. Right. But my opinion is it seems to be kind of almost buried in the Epcot story, right? Mm-hmm. So, well, yeah, we're going to have a theme park as part of my experimental community. Like, there'll be Disney World, but you're going to live here and work here, and everything's going to be involved in this experimental, you know, this is how we could actually live in the future.
Yeah. Right?
And so, and Walt Disney, like, that was his focus. And that's kind of the core history to the East Coast parks. And it's fascinating, right? Because it's also Walt Disney history, right? Mm-hmm. But Disneyland is more, in my kind of never to be humble opinion, the part of his history that involved his own family. Like, I want my daughters to have this experience. I want families to have this experience. You know, I don't want it to be like the nasty carnival down the street. I want it to be safe and beautiful and charming, like, you know. And so that's kind of why, and also I live here, right? So I know Disneyland. So that's why we did that kind of focus.
Well, it's interesting too, to your point about the differences between the different coasts. You know, one of the things that I think, I can't remember like my citation for this, but that Walt didn't like doing the same thing twice. So it was kind of strange to me. With that context of looking at the Epcot video that he did, you know, shortly before he passed, that there was going to be like another Disneyland, which would eventually become the Magic Kingdom, you know, out there, because that's like making the same thing again. And he didn't really like doing that. So that's interesting that that he did kind of duplicate that. And, you know, I always think how amazing it would be if Walt lived longer, like what would have come of that? Yeah. What you know, we'd be so much further. I mean, if you just look, you know, in the you know, however many years, what was it, less than 15 years between Disneyland opening and his passing, you know, was 11 years actually, how he went from basically themed up carnival rides, you know, I mean, they were cool, they still are cool, I'm not knocking them, to Pirates and the Haunted Mansion, you know what I mean? Like, that is mm-hmm. such amount, and audio animatronics and the Tiki Room and all that stuff. That is just such a huge jump in quality and just turning it into something completely different in that short time, that if he would have lived, you know, 20 years longer, you know, what would have come out of that at that point? You know, it's crazy to think about that.
Yeah. I mean, so many thoughts come from what you just said. First of all, I kind of wonder what the audience expected when they went to Disneyland. You know, I do a lot of looking at old newspaper articles and things about, you know, what did people think when they first went to Disneyland in mm-hmm. the 50s? And a lot of people, it seemed to have really good reviews, maybe not for the actual experience in terms of like, oh yeah, the opening day was horrible, or oh yeah, there were so many people we couldn't even move, but more in terms of what they expected and what they got in terms of a lovely atmosphere and a clean place and a safe place. You know, there were hardly any attractions compared to today, right? So yeah. When we were just talking the other day about some 30, there was a, in the 70s, there was a record attendance on a Christmas day at Disneyland of 34,000, I think. And this was before there were, you know, there wasn't Big Thunder Mountain Railroad and Space Mountain and mm-hmm. all these things to take up people off the street. And so like the amount of people that had to be there, it had to be just nothing but walking around mostly, right? And just being in the park, you would have had to wait pretty much half the day for any attraction. Right. So I feel like, you know, I think the audience expected something a little bit different back then than they do now. Now we're looking at attractions and rides and how many things can you do per hour. And I can only imagine people would put themselves into that place because they just wanted to be there.
To go along with what you just said though, you know, the other thing that like I think would be something different about Disneyland back in when it first opened is you could, there is the potential that you could bump into Walt Disney.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you know, it's not as likely nowadays that you're going to bump into, and you don't even care, to be honest. Most people don't care. You know, bumping into, you know, Bob Chapek. Like, nobody yeah. cares if they bump into Bob. You know, most people don't even know what he looks like, first of all. Yeah. But everybody knew Walt Disney. So the fact that, like, you know, you might show up one day and he's there, you know, on the train or driving down Main Street or walking around, like, you could do that back in those days. He was around and in the park. And so, you know, I guess that's kind of how it is now when we've had stories recently of the presidents and stuff of Disneyland and of the park's business being there and kind of around. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's another thing, too, is they expect different things. Plus, you know, like you said, it's something so different than what was around before. So people, you know, because it was such a new thing, just being there, I think, was worth it. But nowadays, I think there's so many other things other than Disney that are similar-ish. You know, you go to, like, Universal. There's some things at SeaWorld and stuff that are similar with different attractions and stuff. So, you know, it's not the only thing that is that, you know.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, competition, the world is just different. And it's always a difficult thing, you know, when you try to compare Disneyland of then with Disneyland of now. And people just want to do that. Like, you can hardly not want to do that because the history is so rich, right? So you yeah. want to track it and you want to follow this path. And, you know, it leads you to say like, oh, I wish this was that and I wish that was this. And there really is, like you just were saying, there's really no competition. I mean, comparison. The competition... Yeah. is strong, right? And that's mm-hmm. and a lot of the competition comes from Disney, quite yeah. honestly. And you know, it'll be interesting. Sidebar: it'll be interesting to see what happens over the next 5 years when half of Disney's trained designers and you know people yeah. that have worked there for so long end up at different entertainment mm-hmm. companies, and you know, to see kind of how that plays out in terms of live themed entertainment. But that's I digress.
but that's a good thing though, because that makes Disney have to work harder, and I think that's a good thing overall. Rather than them kind of resting on their laurels of like, yep, we're awesome.
Yeah. Oh, I agree.
You know when Harry mm-hmm. Potter Land opened, that I think, you know, the Wizarding World of Harry Potter, I think that really lit a fire under Disney to, oh, I guess we've got to start investing again in our parks more substantially. Cause there was that period. I mean, for a long time, 95 with the Indiana Jones Adventure until California Adventure. And that's was the last like kind of new thing. Disney, in fact, what Galaxy's Edge is probably the first new e-ticket since 95, right?
Yeah. I mean,
Disneyland. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And at least it's the response to Harry Potter, you would yeah. say, right? And, mm-hmm. yeah. and, you know, Disney fought so hard to get Harry Potter in the mm-hmm. first place. And so yeah. it's, yeah, I mean, you know, it's kind of an intrigue. There's a lot of intrigue in the theme park industry these days, right? Who gets what and what they're going to mm-hmm. do with it. And I got to say, to be honest, I did not see Harry Potter's, any of Harry Potter at Universal for, I think it was at least 2 years after it opened down in Hollywood before I ever went to Harry Potter. And
sure.
I was thoroughly blown away by the theming, but I was not as blown away by their big giant, Kuka arm or whatever they call the attraction, right? And I expected to be, but I wasn't. I mean, in some ways I was, but I remember thinking like, well, you know, Disneyland's going to do, they're going to come back with something that knocks us out of the, you know, that blows us away.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of have with Galaxy's Edge. So, you know, these things are always going to one up each other back and forth, but it's just, you know, Disneyland, the magic of it is that it is honestly the historical path that it's,
you know,
that's come down, and the history of what Imagineering even means, right? It's so difficult to describe. It's that indescribable quality, right, that you have at Disneyland, but it's a real thing, right? It's a real, and there's nothing to it. I mean, it's got to be history, right?
Yeah.
And the legacy of these people that train the people after them and after them.
Mm-hmm. Well, you got to balance that too, right? Because, you know, there's those people who want to keep some of those legacy things there. And then there's people who are like, well, we got to make room somewhere for the new thing.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, that's, as when you talk to Imagineers, you know, off the record and behind the scenes, and, you know, there's all kinds of horror stories, right?
Oh,
so
yeah.
It's a business. It's a corporation and a business. But, yeah, I mean, philosophically, that's interesting, especially now that so many people have been, like the Disney company has been required to kind of do a start over along with the whole world, you know, because of the pandemic.
Yeah.
But it'll be interesting to see what happens. You know, Mousetalgia, we've followed along. We started 12 years ago, just at the right time to be able to talk to some of Walt's, like, Imagineers, Marty Sklar and Bob Gurr. And we've talked to quite a few people just about what it was like working with Walt, but a lot of Imagineers that we've talked to have also been kind of the second generation, the people trained by the Imagineers that worked with Walt. Disney, the Disney company, has kind of had to chop that generation off, right? So it's almost like I feel like the next, when they start building Imagineering up again, it's kind of going to be maybe a third, like the next generation of Imagineers. So it'll be interesting to, this is just my, my like brain rambling on, but it'll be interesting to see like what if that changes how they you know, approach designing the theme parks. It's just, it's fascinating to me to see what's gonna happen here.
So back to, because you said that one of your big passions with Disney and Disneyland and the Disney company is like the history of it, so how have you just always kind of been interested in that, or did, like, was there something that sparked that? What kind of led you down that path?
That's a great question. I would think I, you know, well, the more involved I became with the Haunted Mansion, the, you know, the more people sent me their stuff and their memories, and some Imagineers kind of said, hey, you know, I did some work for that, you know, and here's some things you might not know. And, you know, that was definitely a big spark for sure.
Sure. Yeah. It's kind of one of those things, once you started, you just like kept getting deeper in it and just wanted more and more and more kind of thing.
I think primarily, I mean, I've always been, I've never been like, I like Disneyland for the rides. I'm not really a big ride person. I love a great immersive ride, but I've, like I said, you know, Haunted Mansion, I was a little timid about that as a kid. I wasn't like a little kid, like, let me go on every ride kind of a, you know, thing. So it wasn't necessarily that. That's a great question. Again, it probably doesn't have a really solid, this is the answer. There's a lot of little things. You know, I've always been, like I said, a media kind of person, involved in media. And Walt Disney was superb at like showing you behind the scenes of things in his media, you know, his shows and the Disney TV shows. I still remember as a little kid, the reruns of Disney Wonderful World or Disney and Walt Disney talking about this attraction and this at Disneyland and that. And so he would give you like a little glimpse of the history of these things, or for him, it was just behind the scenes, you know, what we're doing here. And so, you know, all those little things put together just kind of hit the right spot for me. And
I kind of wish they started to kind of do that with Disney Plus, I think. You know, they had the Imagineering story, which really kind of delved into a lot of the history and stuff. And they kind of catered to people like yourselves and our audience, basically. You know, I wouldn't say that the Imagineering story was a, you know, a general population, everybody's going to watch it kind of thing. But I think for people who are interested in it, that was there. And I'm with you. When I, one of the things I really miss is when the Disney Channel, when I was a kid, the Disney Channel at night would show all those things where, you know, Walt, you know, Disneyland around the seasons and, you know, the Dateline Disneyland stuff, you know, all the old stuff. And, you know, now we've have the Pixar story where they're talking about behind the scenes at Pixar. They had, what was the other one that they,
One Day at Disney.
So that type of stuff is amazing. And I'm glad that at least some small part, and who knows what will happen when things get back after the pandemic. But I do hope that they continue to kind of use their what makes them unique as a selling point. You know, there's content that you can make there. And obviously, you know, you're not going to show, you know, corporate secret things, you know, right away. Mm-hmm. But once an attraction is open, like Rise of the Resistance, I mean, if you're a competing theme park business, you're going to go ride it. And your engineers are going to go ride it, and they're going to know, they're going to start reverse engineering stuff. So at that point, you might as well just put it out there. And I think that makes Disney, that's something that makes people, you know, allows them to be so fond of the Disney companies, because they see how amazing some of their work is. And also, there's a lot of these people who Imagineers, I mean, there's some Imagineers, right? There's the Bob Gers, there's the Tony Baxters, there's, you know, all those people that are kind of the headliners, as the Joe Rohdes. But there's a ton of other Imagineers that work there that have all contributed to these things that really deserve a little bit of spotlight for their contributions to the Disney company over the years as well. And that's why I like these kind of specials, because it's nice to kind of have that history and have that kind of background and show how it kind of develops. Because, like, I'll tell you, we watched, what was it, the Frozen behind the scene thing, and that was crazy, because that came down, yeah. Like, I did not realize a year out from it opening how much of the movie they had left to complete and stuff like that. So just, I think people can appreciate things more when they know how much work goes into them. And I know Disney's kind of thing is, it's magical, and like, it just happens, and we're the only company that can do it or whatever. But I think that people, and it inspires people, inspires the next wave of people. They see that and they're like, that looks like a cool job. I'm going to go to college for engineering, or I'm going to go to college for, you know, art or something, and then get hired in. It's just crazy.
Yeah. You know, it's, I agree with everything you say. I think it's kind of interesting to see, and especially with D23, I think D23 was kind of Disney's attempt to say, like, okay, we're in the computer age. You all know our secrets. So how do we readdress the way we talk to our people and our mm-hmm. fans? You know, there's just not too long before D23 came around, there were still, you know, tell-all books that would be published about Disney, or specifically about Walt Disney, and the company would, like, you know, want to sue and, you know, try to keep everything. You know, it was just a slightly different, well, a largely different situation. And I feel like they're finally starting to say, you know what, people know these things. Mm-hmm. Let's celebrate it, like you say, rather than kind of try to mystify it. And still, it's a little bit, you know, the company still is a little bit reticent maybe to single out individual people, because I think specifically because, like you say, so many people are involved with everything that happens.
Sure.
You know, it's hard to do that. And I think the fans are the ones that single out people like Tony Baxter and Bob Gurr. And, you know, so, and Bob Gurr, we can do that because he doesn't work for Disney anymore. So he can say anything he wants to anyone. You know, Tony Baxter couldn't for a long time. He would, you know, and the Disney company winked and nodded at, you know, like the Disneyana fan club and different places. Even Doom Monkeys had a little bit of that, where we would get, you know, maybe we were doing something that we weren't supposed to talk about, but they knew overall this is a plus for the company, so they'd let me talk to an Imagineer or this or that, you know. But mm-hmm. in general, like, you know, speaking just from my experience with Mousetalgia, like, they don't really want still people talking about what's going on at Disney. They would prefer to kind of control the message. And it's interesting how that's shifting a little bit with D23. Like, of course, they're going to still always, they're a corporation, they're going to control their message, but they're willing to kind of look at many different sides of something instead of just kind of a promotional, you know, shiny angle. Yeah, but it's an evolving story for sure.
Well, I was just going to build off of that and just say D23 is kind of, it was a good response, because I think, right, the company realized that there are people like us Disney nerds out here that love to know, like, we just can't get enough. And so I think they do a really good job of balancing the magic, but then also still giving us a taste to kind of, like, get us interested and want us, you know, keep us hooked, I guess would be a good way of saying mm-hmm. it. And with that, you know, what is kind of, are you guys involved with D23? Do you guys have, like, are you guys members? Do you guys go to the events?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So who doesn't, right?
Well, I mean, but well, I mean, and it was a question like Dave and Becky. So there's four of us on Mousedalgia, myself, mm-hmm. Kristen, Dave and Becky. And Dave and Becky may have both been members for a brief moment, but they're only one of them feels the need at the moment.
Sure.
To be a member. And D23 actually just, I think last week announced changes in their
structure. Yeah.
So maybe they will actually both become members again. I'm not sure. But the point being, you know, if you're not living in Southern California, there's been up until recently, maybe a question of is it worth, should I actually become the member or not?
Yeah.
Now, I personally, as a Disneyana person, like I would pay that much money literally just for these magazines. So, you know what I mean? So everyone has their point of entry mm-hmm. and mine is a little bit easier than some people. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there might have been a question. Now they're trying to address that and trying to be the fan club that everyone has opportunity in. And I think they do a pretty good job of that. I mean, Disneyland has physical locations. The studio is in Burbank. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So, but, you know, I mean, to answer your question, yes, we're very involved with D23 in, I mean, as much as we can be. We're members. We try, you know, we don't get any special perks. Most D23 things I've tried to get into, I never could because it would sell out or whatever.
Sure, yeah.
We've had some good fortune too and been able to do some amazing things with D23. So, you know, because, you know, if you try hard enough and you're around long enough, you'll get into something. Like I was able to go to like the Tomorrowland premiere thanks to D23. That was just good fortune, right?
Yeah, but, wow.
Teresa,
so things like that.
Teresa is dying, and the best thing that ever happened was we met at D23, mm-hmm. the expo. We met Justin and Rafa from the ambassadors, and Teresa has been trying to get on the media list for Disneyland forever.
That's like goal. And, it's going to take forever, but
and
it's a goal.
He said, just keep trying. Like, you'll eventually get there. You just got to keep trying. And that's kind of what I'm getting from you, too, is like, you just got to wait.
If it makes you feel any better, I don't think we're on the Disneyland media list. We were at one time. We got an invitation when they started their the big Princess Fair, you know, and they expanded mm-hmm. Fantasyland. For whatever reason, we were on some kind of media list, and we were invited to that, and they wined us and dined us and had a big media party, and everything was great. And mm-hmm. ever since then, we've been like, how do you get on the Disney?
It seems to me like maybe they've shifted the focus to vloggers, so we just need to invest in video cameras.
Yeah, or just kind of wait for the zeitgeist to come around. It is what it is. Mm-hmm. We have plenty of, you know, sources otherwise.
Oh, yeah.
It's mostly just kind of funny. But yeah, I mean, you know, you just never know exactly what the magic, you know, solution is to some of the stuff.
So this is a question I'm going to ask you, and I don't know if it'll end up in the podcast because I don't know. I guess we'll see how interesting the story is if this ends up in the podcast. But you have obviously talked to a lot of people at Disney and Imagineers and stuff. How the heck do you get on their radar?
Yeah, that's a great question, actually. And it's not a bad question. I don't know if you'll use it or not, but I'll tell you. I wish I could tell you a secret. It's kind of like what Josh, the ambassador said to you. You just kind of have to keep rolling, right? Mm-hmm. And now for Mousedalgia, we started with Doom Buggies, right? I had Doom Buggies. You know, for Doomway's 10th anniversary party, we had Imagineers come, and we rented out the Blue Bayou, and we rented the Haunted Mansion for an hour. Neil Patrick Harris came. Like, it was a high profile.
Wow. Yeah.
Deal, right. So I kind of.
Hold on. I found these names you just dropped on the floor. I think you would like those back.
It's funny, you know, but it's funny because Neil Patrick Harris was a Haunted Mansion fan. I believe he's really is, right? So he just wanted to come.
That's
and it was
awesome.
One of those things.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, what did I have to do with that? Zero. It's a Haunted Mansion, right? The Haunted Mansion draws people, right? Mm-hmm. And so, but we had this super cool party, right? So I just managed to somehow kind of, something has to happen, right? And Rolly Crump, actually, I was introduced by a friend. And so I was able to interview him for almost like the better part of a day about the Haunted Mansion. And that became the core of my Haunted Mansion book, actually, was that interview. So, you know, it's all individual things for Mousedalgia. Kristen, actually, we did an event at the Disneyland Hotel. I was invited to speak. I think just to have a table, I believe, for Doom Buggies. And Kristen came along, and Alice Davis was one of the invited guests to speak at this event. Mm-hmm. And her handler wasn't there. And the person running the event said, "Can someone like help us?" And Kristen like dove in there, and she's like, I would love to do that. She abandoned me completely. And she went and just spent the evening with Alice Davis. And Alice said, "You know what? You should come visit sometime." And so then we started a brief but really enjoyable, you know, few years of relationship with Alice Davis. So
wow.
Things like that just kind of like there's a lot of things. There's serendipity, there's
keep right on place, going. Right time, all that like, kind of stuff.
Yeah. And there's there's the and I mean it helps obviously if you're in LA, right? So but also like the ambassadors told you, there's just stick-to-itiveness. And also now we D23 will you know contact us to help when they want something put out there. So now we kind of have it's not the Disneyland list, but we're on some lists, you know, so,
sure.
So we get information and things like that. But we still get, when we want to talk to someone from Imagineering, chances are 1 out of 10 times they'll say yes.
Sure. You know? Yeah.
And, or same thing, like we just interviewed the director of Raya and the Last Dragon a couple weeks ago. That was really a miracle. I don't actually like, cause we don't have the placement, you know, the media placement to really get that interview. It was mostly just, he heard of us from, or someone that knew us and knew him told him like, this is a worthwhile venture. And it was, so you kind of just have to, I wish I had an answer for you. That was here's how you do it. You just have to keep going, right? We've been doing this for 12 years. Mm-hmm. Our first few years, we did interview Margaret Carey like the first month because I knew her because I'd worked with her. So that's another thing. Like, you know, you kind of, I had made a relationship with her early on, you know, in the decade because she didn't know much about websites and I had done a few. So I helped her out with that and we became friends. And so, you know, there's little, and I had been friends with Imagineers through Doom Buggies for years. So that helped us. Mm-hmm. There's just a lot of little things that help us.
I think that's fascinating. So, you know, it's not just, you know, how can we get those great, amazing people on our show? I just think it's always interesting how these connections are made and how things happen, right? Because like you just said, we just happened to be at, like Alice Davis, we just happened to be at this dinner and it just so happened,
you know, that, we should, you know, Alice Davis needed some help.
It's amazing.
They wanted to be on our show.
They still work for Disney.
I know, but like they could talk, you know, they could talk official Disney stuff. Oh, like they'll just be like, I can't talk about that. And then we just don't put that in the show.
That'd be the whole interview. Nope. Can't talk about that. Nope.
I mean,
can't
talk about that. that's to be honest, worth a try. You know, no one, we have very, very little. That's what I was trying to kind of get at. Like people that are working for the company, it's really difficult to get interviews with them. And it's all about market, right? Niche podcasts like us. Like you and I, our podcast, you know, it's just not the broadcast that they want to spend their time.
Right. Yeah.
Right. So you kind of have to, but on the other hand, they do understand niche marketing to fans. Like they understand that's a thing. And, you know, a few thousand fans can equal, you know, a few tens of thousand just broadcast fans. And they also get that. You just have to kind of be convincing.
I'll tell you. When we started the podcast, I knew that there was probably going to be people that wanted to listen to it because I would want to listen to it. And that's one of the things I've always heard is make something that you want to listen to and people will listen to it. And so, but I'll tell you, once we got the community started and we, the biggest change was we added a shopping channel. And I will tell you, our community loves Disney because I'll tell you, as soon as lockdown happened, I have never seen so many people descend upon Shop Disney shopping event things because they're not spending their money at the park. So they got to spend their Disney money somewhere.
Yep.
So I always just laugh because I'm like, you know, Disney, you know, we might only have, you know, a few thousand listeners or something, but those are like the really dedicated people who love Disneyland, right? Because they sought it out and they listened to it. And so a sell to those folks is so easy if you're trying to sell them Disneyland, you know? So, and I honestly didn't know there was people that was obsessed as much with some of the shopping stuff since this thing. And Teresa's not quite there, but she's definitely skirting it a little bit.
Yeah, I think that brings us into a next topic that, Jeff, you're probably way more of an expert in than we are, Disneyana.
What is Disney Anna? I've heard about it, but I really don't know anything about it.
Yeah, well, I mean, for most people, that involves collecting Disney memorabilia, right? And so some people, and so, for some people, the definition is brought into history and, you know, the whole surroundings of the companies and Walt Disney's background and past. And some people narrowly define these things. This is kind of collectibles and things. I'm a collector. Like, if one of my main roads into Disney is probably collecting, I follow these like the Van Eaton auctions and all of these, and eBay. I'm on eBay every day. You know, I just love to collect things, and it's I love to hold something that I can kind of imagine where it went through its history from when it was created to this day in my hand. Right. And so I just like old Disney Anna that came from the parks or, you know, that was part of the studio and why it was created and why it was made and who might have owned it and how it ended up with me. Right. So that's my entry into the Disney company. And then, you know, there's fan clubs around the country that used to be called Disney Anna fan clubs. Now they've, or National Fantasy fan clubs. Now I think they're called the Disney Anna fan club. And I, you know, they always to some degree have collecting in there. To greater or lesser degrees. Mm-hmm. Some of them are more historical. Some of them are more events and fandom. But yeah, so I don't know if that answers your question.
Well, you said you want to understand from like creation to your hand. And that just reminded me of the prop culture show, which I'm sure you've watched on Disney Plus.
Oh, yeah.
you reminded me, like, I could easily see you being the host of that show with all this. And honestly, I thought a lot of that stuff was fascinating.
It is fascinating.
But I will tell you, some of the stuff surprised me. Like, when they restore things, I never understood what restoration was, where sometimes even though the item is restored and there are parts of it that are the original item, some whole sections of it could not be the original thing. And I didn't ever even think about that.
Oh yeah.
The shrinking gun or the shrinking machine from Honey, I Shrunk the Audiences or Honey, I Shrunk the Kids was one of those because it had been transformed into this totally other thing and they rebuilt it. So there are parts that are still the original thing, but a lot of the parts now are refabricated or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that goes to it's all about the authenticity of the intent of what's happening. You're right. Sure. So for instance, here's a great story. I have a tiki bird. I have a tiki bird.
That's amazing.
Someday, I do have two daughters, so there's a good chance someday I won't have a tiki bird and one of them will, you know, be going to college or something. But I currently have a tiki bird. So I bought this on eBay maybe 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. It was labeled poorly. Like, I think the seller wrote tiki bird is one word. Like, it was. And back there in the day, eBay's intelligence wasn't quite as smart to figure out what it really was. And I just looked at it once and it looked like a piece of garbage, like this little lead, you know, hard and feathered piece of junk. But I just needed to look at it for a second to know, like, that is a tiki bird. So I don't want to tell anyone how much I paid for it, but it was not a lot. Okay. And it had a great pedigree, the guy, and I didn't even need him to tell me like how to convince me it was real. I could just tell by looking at it. But he told me that someone with a window on Main Street had received it, you know, when they were doing a refurbishment. Mm-hmm. So whatever,
bought
this tiki bird. I had it for maybe over a decade, right? And I always felt like, do I restore this or do I leave it in park used condition? Because it was the paint was obviously like 6 or 7 layers of paint on it. It was sloppy. The feathers were kind of getting brown and bent up, and you know they were all kind of disheveled. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you know, I finally, and it's just what you're saying. I kind of had that tie that kind of. I couldn't push myself to do a restoration because this is the patina of a theme park right here.
Right,
like I'm holding a tiki bird that they ripped out of the attraction. It still had the wires. It had all of the actuators and pneumatics inside. Like it was an audio animatronic, like original 1962? I forget. I'm embarrassed, but like it was an original tiki bird, right? Mm-hmm. So I finally bit the bullet and I said, you know what? I want to look at this. I want it to be beautiful. So I hired Kevin Kidney. You've maybe heard of Kevin and Jody. They have designed multiple pieces of Disney merchandise over the decades. And I hired him and I said, I need you to restore this. And so like he stripped all the paint off of it. Mm-hmm. He rebuilt the beak because the beak was cracked. He made the feet to match because it had no feet. It just had wires coming out because it was stuck into a post. And then they had little fake feet on the post.
Yeah.
So he made little fake feet like used to be on the post. He cleaned out all of the innards, the mechanical guts, and he repainted it painstakingly. And he drove to the company that Imagineering used to buy feathers.
Wow.
To buy feathers. I mean, he lives in L.A., so...
Yeah, but still, yeah.
But yeah, but he wanted it to be... So it's what I'm getting at is, like, nothing about that was original, but the intent, like, and the fact that everyone knows who Kevin Kidney is, like, and so the idea is, like, he greatly increased the value of my tiki bird by restoring it, even though, like, we got rid of the theme park paint, like, and, you know, we took off the original beak because it was just all smashed up, and... You know, he took off all the old feathers, which I presume he probably kept in a little baggie somewhere. But he, you know, he put all new feathers on there and new fur. And it's the most beautiful, gorgeous, amazing thing now sitting on my in my cabinet. Right.
You so, have to send us a picture of this, by the way.
Sure. I would be glad to. But so that's, you know, that's kind of my that's when I entered the world of, you know what? Restoration does still if it maintains the intent and integrity of what that thing was supposed to do and be, most collectors view that as just as good as, you know, original or authentic, or sometimes sometimes even better.
So I have to ask this because I feel like with your history of dune buggies, you will know this. This was something that shocked Teresa and I. So two or three of those Van Eaton auctions ago, there was the stretching room portraits, which had like been in the Haunted Mansion. And this is just probably... us being naive, but we were very surprised that the stretching room portraits that are in there now are not the ones that have been in there since day one.
Well, and same thing like with the tiki birds. I'm like, they changed them out. I thought that they just kept, you know.
If you held my tiki bird, you would understand. Like, it's a big piece of lead. I mean, it's not lead, but it's heavy thing, right? And now I'm sure they're plastic and fiberglass. I mean, it might be some fiberglass, but it's really heavy.
Yeah.
And nowadays I'm sure they're very light and, you know, so yeah, I mean, you see those things roll in and out all day long. I mean, they kind of wear out. Right. So, I don't, you know, I can't speak to the Van Eaton ones in particular. I don't really know the history or story behind any of those paintings they've sold. Like, I presume they're real because they say they are. And I know they make multiples of them. So there's no reason to.
Right.
Well, I guess my question was going to be, like, is there anything to any of the attractions? Like, I'll ask you for Haunted Mansion because you probably have, you know, the most knowledge with the Haunted Mansion. But, like, is there anything that they haven't changed, like, that is guaranteed that, like, that was there when it was built and opened and it hasn't been replaced by something fabricated, like, since then? Like, I don't know. I feel like my entire childhood has been a lie or something. Like, I know it's silly, but...
Okay, so you have to step back for a minute and think about what Disneyland is.
Yeah.
It's a place that's open and operating mechanically with heavy mechanics, you know, heavy mechanisms for at least 14 or 16 hours a day, right? So you got to look at what you're talking about here. Like, there's no way that happens for 60 years.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I know, but you know, like, you can understand where I'm coming from, right?
I can. And okay. I, you know, I'm sure the dune buggy clamshells are probably mostly, I would think, those are probably mostly original.
That's true.
You know, Bob Gurr is very proud of the dune buggies, and the fact that they just do not break down, his mechanism is solid. And, you know, I bet you most of the dune buggies, I mean, I'm sure they've had parts put in and out here and there. Who knows if it, over the years, has been a complete overhaul. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I don't think they've ever been changed out.
Right.
I mean, a lot of the attractions have some original stuff here and there. Most of the Fantasyland is not. That was redone in the 80s.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And even that stuff has probably been mostly folded enough. I mean, you got to don't let the magic be destroyed by the knowledge that this is like a big giant robot land that obviously can't, you know.
Well, I was even a lot of surprised because when they repainted the castle, there was a behind the scenes shot that they had taken like some of the facade that looked like the rock work off. And I was like, even the castle. I know this sounds silly, but I feel like our audience, there are people in our audience, I think, that also believe that that maybe it has 40 layers of paint on it, but it's still the thing that was here.
Well,
but it's it may not be.
Yeah, it may not be. I mean, try to keep what we just talked about in mind, the intent versus actuality. Yes. And, you know, like the Haunted Mansion building is the same building. Like, they didn't rebuild that. So, yeah, there's a lot of stuff that is the same thing. The castle is the castle. They didn't ever tear down the castle.
Yeah.
They painted it over and over again. But yeah, I mean,
I feel so silly about it now, but like,
no, there's nothing to feel silly about. It's just mostly, I mean, if anything, like, that's a testament to what Disneyland is trying to do.
Oh, yeah.
Like, maintain memories and nostalgia and magic. Like, that's that's their thing, right? And so they would rather not, you think about what has changed, unless it's for the better, right? They would really probably rather you think about what you remember.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And hopefully it meets those needs.
See, I feel like that's like, there's different levels to being a Disney fan. And once you like make that realization that it's not all the same, that's like a new level. You just leveled up.
Oh, okay. By the way, nobody could see this, but Teresa just reached over and said, you just leveled up, and like patted me on the arm. Like, it's okay, honey.
I find it crazy with that stuff too, though, is what, like, so, right, they're having to replace this stuff because, like you said, Jeff, it's just, you know, it's constantly going. It's, you know, it needs to be replaced so that it can continue to keep going. So the thing that's always fascinating to me is once it's removed, the story of what happens to it after that is, I think, crazy to me, because I don't know. I guess I would have thought that they would have maybe, there probably was a time in the company that they would dismantle them so people wouldn't be able to see it,
or
like
they
how they
away.
Worked, or they just would get thrown away. So it's amazing to me that so much of that stuff is still out there and is still in good enough condition, and that, you know, people are able to have it in their collections, or that they're in museums or whatever.
Yeah, well, I think most of the stuff you see in collections and at Van Eaton, for instance, and, you know, things like that, are probably things that people a lot of it, you know, unfortunately had to surreptitiously make its way out of the park, because a lot of that stuff Disneyland doesn't ever, like costumes and things like that.
Right,
they never give those away. But, you know, a lot of it, I think, is just like my tiki bird, according to the story, which I have no reason to disbelieve, was discarded. And when you're an executive or someone that even probably a cast member that had something to do with what's going on, you know, you might ask your manager, like, do I have to put this in the dumpster? Can I just take this home? And I'm sure in the 60s and 70s and 80s, I think the answer was, I don't care. You know, a lot of the time.
It's going in the garbage. Yeah. Who cares?
And I think a lot of that is what you see happening now. I think it's a little trickier to get stuff out. The newer stuff you see at Van Eaton tends to be collectible stuff and things that were purchased and that kind of stuff. I think it's a little bit harder to just get stuff out of the park. But they still put some of it, they sell it themselves. Some of it, you know, is just excess things they don't need. You just have to, and especially in Florida, there's places where the hotels just unload lots of their past, you know, they'll use stuff for 5 years and then just get rid of it and put new stuff in, and it makes its way to thrift shops and stuff. So yeah, I mean, you know, and if people recognize what it is and they can kind of say, hey, I think that came from the Polynesian Resort, you know, they can take it and clean it up and make a set and sell it at Van Eaton for 10 times as much as
sure.
So, you know, I don't think there's any one way this stuff makes it out into the world, I think.
Right.
But, you know, people like me, like my tiki bird now is a museum-worthy little bird, right? It's not a giant parrot. It's just one of the Glee Club, you know, but it's a great, like, you can take off the back and you can still pull the little levers and make the wings flap. Like, all
so
the,
cool.
You know, all the things are in there to make it go. So it's a history, like it's a piece of history, but it's beautiful. And people like me that want to keep the stuff and put a little effort into making it something worth, you know, remembering, that's what you see happening. So it's a little bit of a lot of things, I think.
You know, one of the things that's so amazing about your tiki bird is just, you know, it doesn't matter that it wasn't one of the big birds, you know, that was in Disneyland. Mm-hmm. Thousands of people watched that thing perform, and this place that you love so much, a tiny piece of it, you know, is in your house.
Yeah, it wouldn't be It wouldn't be stretching the truth for me to say, I hope neither of my daughters really want to go to college. But, you know, that's kind of a joke. But yeah, to the reality of what you're saying is, yeah, that's history. Like, that's why I collect things. Like, it's the perfect example. Like, mm-hmm. that existed. You know, Disneyland a few years ago sold little chunks of the Matterhorn, I think during the 50th anniversary, just because they were renovating it a little bit.
Yeah,
sure. Yeah.
Sold little chunks. Even that, I bought one of those and I'm like, I have a piece of plaster here that was this is Matterhorn Mountain, mm-hmm. right? And it's just a little chunk of garbage, right? But it's kind of what it represents, you know, in your brain. Like you say, like, yeah, but it was part of this massive, unique, mm-hmm. you know, thing. Mm-hmm.
So what would you say your most, do you have a favorite or your most prized piece of collection from your Disneyana?
Yeah, you know,
I don't know how that seems like an impossible question.
And if it's
question.
The Tiki Bird, what's your second?
Yeah, you know, I don't know if I would say it's the Tiki Bird. I have a brown line of Sleeping Beauty Castle that I got it also at Van Eaton, but before the auctions. This was many, many years ago when they were just an animation cell, you know, company, and they had it all folded up and it was kind of ripping in the seams. But it was a wed brown line from the 60s of Sleeping Beauty Castle. So it was somehow involved with, you know, Wed had for some reason published it. It was signed by the artist that worked at Wed at the time. And I just thought, this sounds like something significant. And, you know, no one was really bidding on it. It was on eBay and the bids were not very high because it looked like garbage. Like, that's kind of the, I guess if you're gathering anything from me, it's like garbage, right? So, but I kind of knew what it was, right? So I bought it and I took it to a poster restorer, and I didn't really have it restored because you can't really restore those things, but it was starting to fade. So I wanted it to, as much as it could, stop fading. So they washed it and they put it onto cotton paper so it would, you know, stabilize. And it's now the most beautiful thing. Like, it's from the office, the Wed offices, you know, from the 60s. It's signed by the artist that actually made it for Wed. And you could tell it was, you know, something that they had up on the wall for whatever reason, you know, whether they were just doing a presentation or, you know, for some reason needed to visualize Sleeping Beauty Castle. And I think that's probably my favorite thing. Wow.
That sounds like a pretty amazing favorite thing.
Yeah.
That would be amazing. You're right, though. I feel like a lot of collections, and if you've watched any of those things like the Antiques Roadshow and stuff, it's always people have no idea what they have.
Right.
Yeah.
And then they'll bring it in and they'll be like, I don't know what this is. And they're like, oh my gosh, there was only like three of these ever made and it's worth $10 million. And people are like, oh, interesting. Okay, cool. Yeah. And then, you know, and then you got to, of course, find somebody who's willing to pay $10 million or whatever for it.
Yeah. You know, and I've talked to Mike Van Eaton about this before. I told him, you remember that? He remembers this thing. Like, he kind of knew what he had, but his business was just selling his stuff. And he didn't, you know, he can't restore everything he has. And he was spending his time restoring his cells. So he would sell restored animation cells, but he couldn't, you know, pay to have this, you know, taken care of just in case someone would buy it. Now, if he knew he would become the auction house that really was known for Disneyland memorabilia, he probably would have kept it because now it probably would sell for multiple thousands of dollars.
Right.
That's not anything like what I paid for this folded up thing. Right. But, you know, he has a business. So, you know, he had to make money. So, yeah.
Again, right place, right time.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I'm a collector, right? So, at some time, I'm going to be in the right place in the right time. You know, 20 out of 21 times, I won't be. And I'll miss the auction, or I won't get the bid, or I won't this or that. But once in a while, like with the bird or the poster, you know, good fortune.
Pretty amazing.
Wow. So
pretty amazing.
How large is your collection, would you say? I feel like that's the other thing we got to.
Yeah. I don't know, because I go in bits and pieces. Like, for a while, I've been mostly focusing on collecting signed books because I don't know why, I just have been. And because I'm near the Walt Disney Family Museum here in San Jose where I live, so I can go there a lot and get a lot of autographs and things. So I've kind of been doing a lot of book collecting lately. I also have too many focuses. Like, Haunted Mansion, I have tons of Haunted Mansion collectibles. That's probably my largest collection, but I also... I'm a big Mickey Mouse collector, and lately I've been trying to get like things from the 30s and 40s, you know, that are involved with Mickey Mouse and the Mickey Mouse Club. And that's a little bit harder to find, you know, mm-hmm. these days. And so I love Peter Pan and Tinkerbell, Mark Davis version of Tinkerbell. So I collect Mark Davis era Tinkerbell, you know, figurines, yeah. and artwork, and publications and things. So, and Disneyland, of course, big mm-hmm. Disneyland history fan. So Disneyland tickets and Disneyland ephemera of all kinds.
It's now, fascinating to me that so many Disneyland tickets still exist. Yeah. Who are these people that didn't use up their ticket books?
Well, well, that's one thing. But like I still in my office at home, I have my ticket from like 19, the late 80s. Because mm-hmm. they would just stamp it with like mm-hmm. one of those little things that you can buy at the store. You just turn the date to it. You yep. stamp it. You know, that's. That was like the limit of technology. I mean, yeah. they would never get away with that now with counterfeiting and everything.
Yeah.
What's your oldest ticket that you have?
Oh, I have none of this is my own tickets. This is my collection.
Sure.
But I do have a gate ticket from, I think it was 57 or 56 or 57, around the opening year. I don't have a 1955 ticket book. Or any of the, I kind of want to collect all the little individual attraction tickets that they used to sell. I haven't started that yet. And I don't know if I will, I just have too many collections going on, but I did want at least an entrance because most of the ticket books you buy on eBay don't have the ticket to get into Disneyland because everyone went in there,
yeah.
but mm-hmm. then they would use a couple tickets. So it's kind of harder to find those. And I did finally find one from the early 50s. So I have that and that's probably my earliest, coolest. Ticket.
The thing I find so cool, okay, so not only the fact that people didn't use the tickets and they hung on to the ticket books, but the thing that's crazy to me about these to collect now especially is it's a piece of paper, you know, so how has this paper existed for this long and has survived for this long for then it to come into your collection? I think that's just amazing.
Yeah, well, that's ephemera, right? It's supposed to be ephemeral, but it's not because mm-hmm. someone put it in their desk and forgot about it.
Yep.
You know what I mean? Or they mostly find it in grandma's attic, or the classic grandma's attic, right? So, yeah, I mean, that's actually a good question. I mean, I have lots of my stuff from the 80s because I'm an ephemera guy. So perhaps maybe some of these things are people that actually just thought, this is cool. I'm just going to keep it in my cabinet and it just sat there for decades, you know?
That's true. That's very true.
You know what's crazy too is, you know, you look at things like tickets and for a short time we had a second podcast that it was me and a different person hosting that was about Disney, the other Disney parks around the world that wasn't Disneyland. And one of the things I made for Perks is I made a bunch of graphics for like the different levels on Patreon and stuff, and they looked like old ticket books. And I remember that was the first time I actually spent time closely looking at the design, and as simple as the ticket books are, like they're kind of weird little works of art.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, I mean, everything, well, it's kind of hard to separate yourself from iconography, right? So once something becomes iconic, like the E, giant red E on and on the green, lovely, you know, with the watermark texture mm-hmm. waves behind it. Like you kind of just think like, how could anything be more perfect than this? But, you know, it's because it's so iconic in it, for me, like it's so iconic in my mind as, mm-hmm. as a perfect ephemeral memory of Disneyland. But yeah, there's, you know, because they would have to change them all the time, you know, when new attractions would come and go. And some years, I think there were three or four different ticket designs in a year sometimes because things would come and go and they'd have to just redo the tickets. So they all, you know, were accurate.
The other thing I feel like as time has gone on, and I'm sure you can agree with this, is I feel like there was like more design to the old things. I don't know. Like there was more artistry to it. Cause like a lot of the things you get now, especially like ticket stock is like, oh, it's a picture of Mickey and it says Disneyland on it. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, like Disneyland, you know, the new one, the old ones, I'm looking at one on eBay right now from, it's a 12 adventure ticket book C&D adult thing for $4.35. It's not in good condition, but I'm looking at it mm-hmm. and like the coloring and just the font and it just looks cool. You know, it had a distinct style to it where I feel like lately I was even thinking about this with the annual passes recently is when I first had the annual pass back in the early 2000s, it was like it, there was a design to it that looked neat. And I feel like nowadays it's just, here's a picture of Mickey and it says annual pass.
And characters. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there's a part of that is historical, the history of design, corporate design. And part of it is how Disney changed from Walt's leadership. In the 50s, you know, you could tell what Walt liked. And also Disneyland was all his animators. Well, he also hired, it was all artists. He'd hire either art directors from Fox or, you know, other Hollywood studios, or he'd pull people out of animation. So they were all visual artists. And even the people working on the graphics and advertising and the design. Now, as the park grew, of course, there would be graphics people and designers for doing just print and things like that. But mid-century design also had just a flair, the same way that corporate design now, the idea is to keep it clean and straight, right? So Disney, it's really not immune to any of this stuff that happens. That's why so many Disneyland collectors, they love early Disneyland, because the 50s and 60s and even the early 70s, that's mid-century. Like, you know, there were artists working mostly by hand on this stuff, right? And so even the typography and everything is, you know, hand created. And nowadays, you know, half Disney stuff, half the stuff that would have been designed is now done in-house, you know, because you can, because Adobe made a template for it. So,
right.
You know what I mean? So that's not just Disney, that's corporate America. So, you know, yeah, I totally agree with you. You know, the early Disney stuff is just, it's just different. But I mean, I guess what I would say is you find that about most companies that existed throughout this whole time, especially think about Coca-Cola in the 50s. Man, they had the most gorgeous advertisements, paintings, and the most amazing creative campaigns. And, you know, it's different. In the 70s, it was more about music and, you know, attitude. And now it's just very corporate. Like, we're going through this time of marketing history. Where
I will tell you, though, I was so happy when they brought back the Disneyland font, when they got rid of the Disneyland Resort, like, weird mashup of, you know what I'm talking about. It had, like, the Disney signature thing that said Disney, but then, like, land was in, like, Ariel or something.
Yeah.
I was so glad they brought back that kind of thematic, like, Fantasyland-looking font.
Yeah, I totally agree. That was a good move. And they'll make great moves, and they'll probably make some more clunker moves. Like, you know, like, that's our corporate our corporate overlords. But, you know, generally speaking, Disney, as a company, they respect their history, right? So it's sooner, at least so far, in my experience with being a fan of the company, things have come and gone, but it seems to settle in a pretty good place. You know, and this is actually, like I was mentioning earlier, this is an interesting time with lots of people being laid off and seeing what happens when the company restarts, and if that actually changes some of the perspective. And, you know, it'll be really fascinating to see what happens.
But, it will.
You know, I agree with you in general. Like, who doesn't love mid-century Disney? Like, everything. Their movies, their movie posters, Disneyland, you know, just the marketing.
Their attraction posters.
Yeah, everything is just so gorgeous and amazing, right?
Now you've made me sad, but that's okay. It's good, right? At least we had it at some point.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, that, and it is very, it's exemplary of mid-century design, right? So that doesn't exist anywhere anymore. It's not just Disney. It's just that was a period of design, and we, you know, we're fortunate that Disney embraced it and just put out so many gorgeous things in that era.
Mm-hmm.
Very true. What are some of the other, I feel like you're very deep into Disney.
Everything.
We've got history, we've got Disney, and of course the podcast, Doom Buggies. Is there, you know, anything else that we haven't talked about that you've done Disney-wise?
Oh yeah, I wrote a book.
It's wow. That's impressive.
Yeah, and I think I kind of mentioned, I had known all this stuff about the Haunted Mansion, right? Because I did Doom Buggies, and I've written numbers of magazine articles, and I've been interviewed about it many times. And I just thought, I thought a story of the history was something that people would want to hear. A friend of mine who's an Imagineer, Jason Sorrell, had written the Disney official Haunted Mansion book.
Oh,
and I'm proud to say he was on Doom Buggies for a while before that, kind of, you know, feeling out, you know, the fandom and things like that. And it's an amazing book, but it's pictures, right? Because that's what they could sell, a picture book, and only Disney can, like, sell their own pictures, right? And so, and he would tell us, you know, he talked to us all the time about it and say, oh, I wish I could have put in so much stuff, but you know, this is the book they wanted to sell, a mass market paperback about the Haunted Mansion, right? And it had to also tie in the movie. So he was really limited, right?
Yeah,
to what he could do. And so I just had been thinking about that for many years. And I finally figured, you know, I just want to write it. I just want to write this for my own self to get it out of my head. So I, it kind of came together when I had this chance to talk to Roly Crump for a good part of the day about the Haunted Mansion. And, you know, we heard, he told me stories I had already known. He told me some things I didn't, but the gist of it was I had my own, like, big piece of his side of the history that I could, like, put in the center of all these stories that I'd already known and turn into a book, right? So I wrote this book. It's called The Unauthorized Story of Walt Disney's Haunted Mansion. By Jeff Bam. And you can, if you want to find it, you can find it at, well, it's on Amazon, but you can find it at doombuggies.com/book. Easy way to get there.
We'll put a link in our show notes as well.
Oh, sure. Thanks. But it's, yeah, I mean, it's been out for a few years now, but I really, I'm proud of it. I think it tells, you know, it's a great, if you get Jason's book and mine, put them together, like, you know, it's great because he has pictures. I put in some pictures, but we couldn't really, you know, we might have pushed some of the limits already with the ones we put in there. We didn't want to just use Disney's copyrighted pictures.
Sure, but
But the history, you know, is for everyone. And it's a fascinating story, really, the story of the Haunted Mansion, because Walt died during the making of the Haunted Mansion. Mm-hmm. He gave them a lot of, like, I'm not sure, but let's try this, let's try this, let's try this, and then passed away, right? So the Imagineers had this moment. I know, right? And so the Imagineers really had this time of, well, who's in charge and who gets to say what we do and what's going to happen. Right. And so it's a really an interesting story. And that's what I tried to tell in the book. And I think it worked out pretty well. So if you're interested, doombuggies.com/book.
Oh, for sure. I was actually chatting with Lynn from the Sweep Spot about you and about this book. And I told him, I said, I need to turn in my Haunted Mansion fan club card. Cause how did I not know that this book existed? Sounds amazing. So personally, we'll definitely be visiting and ordering a copy because this sounds fascinating.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it was a labor of love. So yeah, I hope you like it.
Oh, for
sure. I love reading any of the Disney stuff. And actually, I see I might end up purchasing this online tonight because I have been looking for a book to read on my iPad because I bought an iPad because I wanted to read more. Yeah. As one of the reasons. So I was like, okay, well, maybe you'll be one of the first things I read on the thing.
Perfect. Well, maybe we'll have to have you after Tag and I take the time and read and enjoy the book. We'll have to have you back on to talk more about that later.
I feel like we could have a great Haunted Mansion discussion for sure.
Yes.
Sure. Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for spending so much of your time and evening with us. We went all over the place and it was super fun.
We took a grand circle tour of Jeff's
and then
everything.
So we just want to leave you with one final question. So if you've ever worked at the parks or if you've ever considered working at the parks, but if you could and you could make up your own position or take a position that does currently exist, what would you do if you could work at the parks?
You know what? I have not ever worked at the parks. To be honest, in reality, I'm not sure that I would do so great working with the public, you know,
sure.
but who doesn't want, I mean, there was a time, I don't know, a decade ago or so where maybe more than that, where Disney had to be a cast member for a day contest and you could send in a video of yourself and you could try, you know, applying for whatever role you wanted to be. And a certain number of people got lucky and were allowed to do that for a day. I didn't try out or anything, but one of the options was become a Haunted Mansion butler. And, you know, I mean, it might be a little obvious, but I had some Doombuggies friends that won, like a number of them won the chance to become a butler for a day.
Oh, that's awesome.
And, you know, they all reported back what an amazing experience it was. And because they got to go through a little mini cast member training and they get to wear the costume and maybe something like that. I might not mind just running an attraction for a day. You know, that would be okay.
Did they get to walk through the attraction? That's the question.
You know, I don't remember. I think by that time Disney was clamping down on that kind of thing. So I doubt it. And you know, that's one thing I've never been able to do also. So maybe that's another reason I'd like to become a Haunted Mansion. Maybe for more than a day. So I could actually finally see like what's behind the curtain.
Right. Go explore a little bit deeper.
Yeah.
The closest I ever got, and I don't know if you've ever had this experience, Jeff, but my mom, one of our trips had some knee problems. So she ended up being in one of the electronic convenience vehicles. Well, you can't exit, the normal exit at Haunted Mansion if you have one of those. So we got to, they said, stay on the Doom Buggy. And we went through past the offload and went into this weird backstage area and then came back out where you load. And we got to go back up the stretching room, which I will tell all of our listeners is not that exciting because they don't have any sound or anything. Literally, it is quiet, and all you hear is the creaking of everything around you and the paintings rolling up and clicking together and everything. It's very, I mean, I don't know. I feel like that's probably the thing that's ruined the magic the most for me. Just that experience. Not that it ruined the Haunted Mansion, right, but that was the least magical.
Like, this is going to be amazing.
Yeah.
Oh.
And I was like, oh, this isn't that exciting at all. And then the cast member was just real quiet. And it was just weird.
That's funny. You know, my dad has a disability. So we have done that same thing. I've gone.
Yeah.
And, you know, for a minute there, it is kind of exciting. You kind of go over the hill, like you go around the corner and over the hill and you're like, oh, where are we? And then you're back at the loading zone again.
Yeah.
But yeah, I would agree. Disney, they make, like, once the lights got turned on for me in Indiana Jones, and literally there were boxes and a broom in the corner of the
house. Oh, no!
We were under the Rolling Stone when it locked down.
Oh.
And then finally they turned on the lights. And yeah, that room is, they store stuff in there. So, you know, things like that, you know, they don't really, they hope you don't really see that stuff. But, you know,
right.
I guess why not?
I have a question for you. Since I know we said that was our last question, but it just dawned on me that you might know, or have a guess better than some others, since you have a pretty good knowledge of the Haunted Mansion. How will Disneyland do the social distancing when they reopen for the Haunted Mansion? Because in Florida, you could just walk through the stretching room, and that's what they have set up. But Disneyland, you actually have to go up and down.
You're going to have the dots.
Well, that's a good question. So you might remember they closed the Haunted Mansion down for most of, I don't know, it had been a good three, I think, maybe 3 months when they finally went into full. Like, it hadn't opened after the Haunted Mansion holiday.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
So they may be able to keep it closed a little longer and say they're still renovating it. Mm-hmm. Honestly, it will slow way. If they need to just bring, you know, four people at a time down that elevator, I don't know what they're going to do.
Yeah. I think the only way that they can do it, when we visited Walt Disney World, is they, Rise of the Resistance is the one that really stuck out to me, is they had colored dots. And so, like, we were the blue group. So every place that they would kind of be an area that you weren't either on the attraction or having to wait, and they didn't want you to,
you go stand on a blue dot.
You weren't standing in a queue line. You'd find the blue dot and you'd stand on the blue dot. So I feel like they're going to have to have some sort of dot system.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
And I said four, but realistically, they probably can't keep more than 12, I don't know, 10 or 12 people in their 6 feet apart. So
right.
It'll be interesting.
Plus, then the cast member that also has to be.
They can't tell you to drag your bodies to the dead center of the room. They'll be like, everybody stay up against the wall.
Yeah.
Don't.
Maybe there could be some sort of a spin with 6 feet.
There you go.
Who knows?
Yeah, who knows?
It's going to be interesting.
Well, again, thank you so much, Jeff. We had so much fun talking to you and learned all sorts of fun new things.
I am sure that at some point we will have you on again, because I feel like it would be wonderful to talk to you just about the Haunted Mansion, and especially after we've read your book, which like I said, I think we will definitely pick up and read.
Yeah.
Well, sure. I would be glad to join you again, and thank you so much for having me. This has been super fun.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Jeff. Well, now it's time to return, tails tucked in between our legs, to Trivia Land with producer Vern, because we did not give you the correct answers to this week's trivia. So please, please, Vern, you need to tell us, because we are
put us out of our misery.
Give yourself some credit. You got one correct tonight.
Probably the pirate one is the only
you got one.
One
resoundingly correct. You had the right answer, the first words out of your mouth, and you did great. So the listeners did not completely stump you tonight. So you did very well on that one. Your first listener submitted question tonight from listener Brittany R. Who designed the famous purple wallpaper in the Haunted Mansion? That was WED designer Tanya Norris.
Tanya Norris.
Tanya Norris. Tanya based the designs on Raleigh Crump's sketches of spooky chandeliers that could be used in the Haunted Mansion. Tanya was the fifth woman to work at WED and was hired to manage the interior design of the Haunted Mansion.
Well, you had all the facts right, Teresa. You just didn't have who it was.
I just didn't know the name. Maybe that's like a quarter of a credit.
I don't know.
The second question submitted by listener Jill M. When you are on the Mark Twain riverboat, what does the narrator tell you Tom Sawyer always wanted to be? a pirate.
Hey, we did get that one right. Good job, Teresa.
You did very well on that one. Your third question, submitted by listener Donna S. What were the names of the turkeys that were Grand Marshal for the first Thanksgiving Day parade at Disneyland?
Please be dumb.
Those turkeys were named Marshmallow and Yam.
Wow.
We
nowhere near close.
You
that's cute.
Say this, but I... Yes, I remember that now because those were cute anyway. I didn't remember them when it mattered.
This took place in 2005. Those turkeys came from the White House. President George W. Bush pardoned them and sent them to Disneyland.
Yeah, I do remember them coming from the White House. I do remember all
that. I don't
know.
If we don't start doing better on this trivia, we're going to need a pardon to go to the, from the White House.
And your fourth regular round question, submitted by listener Lee S. Mickey and Minnie's Runaway Railroad is advertised as the first Disney Parks attraction based on Mickey Mouse. This is not necessarily true. What is the first Disney Parks attraction to be based on Mickey Mouse? The Mickey Mouse Club Theater opened in Disneyland in Fantasyland in 1955.
Aww.
It showed classic Disney shorts.
Yeah. Because that's where I think Pinocchio is now.
Right. But see, I think that what it is when they say attraction, they mean like ride.
Yeah, but that wasn't a ride.
I know.
Oh, no.
What I'm saying, what I'm saying is they say it was the first Mickey Mouse attraction because they mean ride.
Right. Yes.
Attraction encompasses everything.
Yes, a very broad term.
Mm-hmm. But Disney doesn't like to call things rides. They call them attractions and amusement or attractions and
shows. There's also
shows and attractions. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So by their own terminology of all of our things are attractions, they're breaking their own rule by saying it's the first attraction.
Sure.
Ish. They may have considered it something else at the time. I don't know. Interesting. A theater. They considered it maybe they decided it was a theater, not an attraction. I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay. Now on our bonus, we got to know what those train things are.
So your bonus question submitted by listener Lori D. What are the names of the train engines on Big Thunder Mountain Railroad? They were not Dynamite Dan or
whatever else you threw out.
I don't even remember what I said.
Any of the rest of the spaghetti you threw against the wall.
Sometimes it sticks.
They were UB Bold.
Oh.
You Are Courageous. I Am Loco.
That's a good one.
I Be Hearty. And You Are Daring.
Fun.
I knew they were cutesy ones like that.
I'm gonna have to pay attention, and like I don't even know if
that's
like a huge thing
for you though, to pay attention at Disney.
I know, but I don't even think I can like picture what the little like what the names look like on the trains. You know what I mean? Like I don't even know if I can.
I've seen them, I just couldn't remember them.
I know what at least I can like picture in my mind what the names on the boats for the Jungle Cruise look like, and I can picture in my mind what the names look like for the pirates' boats.
Sure.
But I don't think I've ever paid that close of attention. Turning in all the cards tonight.
Yeah, because they're like right here.
Okay. Maybe I have noticed it, but never like read them or something.
That sounds right. Well, because you're not thinking about it, right? You're just trying.
I'm too excited to get on the dang attraction.
Well, listeners, how do you think they did? Oh, how did you do listening at home? Do you think that you have the questions that can stump them next week? If you would like to contribute some questions of your own, feel free to send those over to producer James and I at trivia@dlweekly.net.
Well, we will be back next week with more Disneyland news and information.
Until then, have courage, be kind, and spread some Disney magic.
Ladies and gentlemen, Disneyland has now ended its normal operating day. We hope you've enjoyed your visit to the Magic Kingdom and that you'll be back with us again soon.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Wake up to a delicious morning with your favorite McDonald's breakfast sandwiches, now just $2, only in the app. Choose from a bacon, egg, and cheese biscuit, sausage McMuffin, or bacon, egg, and cheese McGriddles, just $2, only in the app. That's a deal as irresistible as the sandwiches themselves. Plus, you'll save time by ordering ahead in the app. Offer valid one time per day from July 29th through September 1st at participating McDonald's. Must opt in to rewards.